Okay, so it's 9 o'clock. Welcome, everybody. Firstly, in Nkululeko, can I just check, are there any apologies?
No, any, sir. If any no.
Apologies. Okay, so there's no apologies. I presume people are here, will join us shortly, right? What I wanted to say is that Comrade Njadu is caught up. I was in the meeting myself. I had to leave. They're finishing at 10, a chairperson's forum meeting to discuss the program for the rest of this term. That also influences our committee's processing of the tax bills. So that I can deal with in-house tomorrow. For now, welcome to everybody, in particular the stakeholders. Are they all here in Nkululeko, Smart Funder onwards? They here, are they? Are they connected, in other words?
Some of them are here. Sorry. Chairperson, they are meaning well, Smart Funder.
Okay, welcome to them in particular. Just to alert the committee, on Sunday when I exchanged with Nkululeko Mangweni, our committee secretary, we had only one oral submission, Francois, that's how you say, Liebenberg. And so we decided we would be able to proceed and do much of the work this week. But suddenly there was a flood of requests yesterday morning, and Esther and Poppy, the summary we asked you to do was based on the understanding that, and I tried to reach you, Esther, just before this meeting, the summary was, you asked to do the summary because we took it that there was only one oral submission and the others are written, so there has to be a summary before we can proceed clause by clause and decide on the policy issues even before that. So now that we have so many, clearly your summary will be used tomorrow. And for now, it's Treasury that has to do much of the work in regard to the submissions orally today and those that are now before us in written form. So, you know, we will still use your document, Esther and Poppy, but that'll be tomorrow. Apologies. Sorry, I've been in another meeting. In fact, I've been meeting since 8 o'clock. Needless to say, this virtual meeting has gone mad culture, as I call it. Just to make clear to stakeholders, there was a request from one stakeholder. It was meant well to meet with me to discuss a certain issue. I explained that if a matter is before the committee, especially before a public hearing, it's inappropriate for me to meet any one particular stakeholder, as it will seem like unfair to the other stakeholders and to the committee. So please, those of you who make submissions for public hearings, please understand that the norm, at least while I'm, I think it's the norm in Parliament, and certainly it's the norm by which I abide. And until somebody can show me a rule that allows me to deviate from that, I will stick by that. But the person hadn't meant to do anything more, and presumably think that if they spoke to me for a longer period than the submissions allow for the 10 minutes, they might be heard better. But in fact, let me start with that. Some of you I know through my chairpersonship of the NA committee. It's to say that, look, although we give you only 10 minutes, remember, between the research team, myself as the chair, some of the committee members, and National Treasury, although they're on the other side of the divide, they're the executive, we parliament, we look at all these submissions, believe me, we have to read them. Some of them are very complex and technical. I've never hidden it. My sixth year chairing a finance committee in this parliament, been here since 94, and believe you me, I've chaired how many, five committees. I've never found anything more challenging than the tax bills. But I gather this is a case in established democracies too. We did some research in 1994 on how committees process tax bills, and I was astonished to see how much of this is driven by technical experts. All the ultimate decision makers remain the elected politicians, certainly more than in other areas of policy and formulation and legislative work. But be that as it may, this committee will apply its mind in terms of its constitutional duty. So I should say that for those of you who appeared before the National Assembly Committee and found that they wouldn't agree with you, it doesn't mean we won't agree with you, obviously, except that it's a Section 75 bill, to remind you, which means that in this case, all we can do is alert the NA committee through a report that we disagree with them, but we have no power to prevail over them. they can either agree with what we are proposing or reject it. But it's not a Section 76 bill, a concurrent power and function, which means the provinces have a major say, in which case we have equal power, so to speak. So those of you been heard at NA and been heard by National Treasury, that's less important. We don't care so much what National Treasury thinks, because that's the executive. We care more what the National Assembly Standing Committee on Finance thinks. So, you know, they've heard you. I don't know whether the system still exists on the NA side where you have offline discussions and try to have a consensus, but it does mean that if you've been there already, it might be in your own interest to say new things. Not that you can't repeat what you say, because we might come to a different view, but it's better that you say, we've raised this National Assembly, they didn't agree with it, but we heard them, but this is our reply. We think it's still worth pursuing so that we have a better idea, because obviously we're going to compare notes with what you said there and what you're saying. Yeah. Having said that, Smart Finder is on. I'm using the clock here at 8 minutes. I will alert you to the fact that you've got 2 minutes. Please understand, we will read your entire document. We've got a big team on our side in Parliament, both in the technical side and, of course, some of the MPs will certainly read it. So, Smart Funder, you here?
Honourable Chair, I'm present. Thank you very much.
Right, go ahead. I'm timing you. You can time yourself as well. Okay, go ahead, please. 10 minutes. Thank you.
Perfect. Honourable Chair, just to confirm, can you see my screen?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you very much. So yes, thank you very much, Honourable Chair, for the opportunity to present to you this morning. I think the context that you've given, as always, is great. I'm Francois Liebenberg. I'm a director of Smart Funder, which is an SMME that assists companies with administration of bursaries. Completely aware of the time constraints, it's very difficult with technical matters to cover it, but I've prepared slides for 10 minutes, so I will really stick to that. The reason why I'm here today is to shed information and make sure everyone is 100% on the same page as to exactly what this entails to aid you in your deliberations when you go forward. And to start off, I would like to present the following quote, because when it comes to tax bills, most of the time it's about money only, but when it comes to education, it's about more than money. So education is the great engine of personal development. It's through education that the daughter of a peasant can become a doctor, and the son of a mine worker can become the head of a mine. The child of farm workers can become the president of a great nation. It's what we have, not what we are given, that separates one person from another. And the reason why this quote is important is, as I say, it's about more than just the money when we consider Section 10.1Q specifically. Now, I'd like to stop and focus here. An Honourable Chair, I think this wasn't discussed in great detail in the Standing Committee, so it's very good always to know what the history of legislation is. And as you will recall from National Treasury's presentation last week, this law has existed since the 1990s, but in 2006, a very important thing happened, and I'll take you through exactly what that is. So in 2006, National Treasury took decisive action to change Section 10.1Q of the Income Tax Act to allow employers to offer bona fide bursaries to employees and their relatives in a non-taxable way by manner of salary sacrifice. These are two words that you will see featured, and we'll elaborate on them a little more now in time. It's definitely one of the more powerful initiatives that National Treasury has released, but I don't want to convince anyone of how this should be interpreted. We've actually drawn up the document from 2006 for you to have a read yourself and make your own conclusions as to exactly what the purpose of this was. So if you have a look at the National Treasury explanatory memorandum in 2006, you will see that firstly, it is called an incentive for employee scholarships and bursaries, which is important. It's not an anomaly or a loophole in the tax law. It is an incentive that was put forward very deliberately by National Treasury in 2006. Current law in the context of the document reads that what it said in 2006, so it talks about bona fide scholarships and bursaries and that taxation would arise for these bursaries if any element of salary sacrifice was present at the time. To avoid further confusion, current law at the time contained anti-avoidance charges to dissuade any employers from providing bursaries or scholarships on salary sacrifice. Now, there's always a reason for a change in tax law, as we'll touch on today too. And the rationale put forward for the change in 2006 is a very highly applicable still today. The distinction made little economic sense in the light of skill shortage. So to recap, the current law said that if a bona fide bursary had salary sacrifice, it was not allowable. There was a very good reason for the change, and this was the change. All bona fide scholarships and bursaries for employees will be tax exempt regardless of whether or not elements of a salary sacrifice are present. So if you have a look at what happened in 2006, a very decisive step was taken to allow for salary sacrifice on bona fide bursaries and scholarships. That's the first point. So if we go further, let's have a look at further history and the evolution of this. You will see that from 2012, and again into 2013, 2016, and once again in 2017, not only has National Treasury allowed for the incentive, but the employees who qualify for the benefit have become more inclusive. So this was a decision taken to lift the monetary thresholds, and initially employees had to earn 100,000 Rand or less to qualify for the benefit. This was made more inclusive by allowing for employees who earn 250,000 or less. Once again, it was lifted, and it was lifted again. So where we are today, this law covers for the middle class of 600,000 Rand or less, which is defined in the Act, and 20,000 Rand is very much aligned with school fees and 60,000 for tertiary fees. So the law is quite sensible, and you will see that it has been lifted over time to allow and incentivize more people to use it. As a practical example, tax-free savings used to be 30,000 Rand. Treasury lifted it to 33,000 Rand, and the recent amendment is 36,000 Rand. And that is to get more people to use tax-free savings. So the second point here is, not only was this made an allowable incentive, but you've got to ask yourself the question, if National Treasury lifts the limits to make this applicable to more people and incentivize uptake, would you expect a bigger uptake? So let's go forward and look at a practical example, and I'll briefly touch on this. We know an employee needs to earn less than 600,000 Rand a year. So under this incentive, an employee can voluntarily give up a part of their salary in exchange for a non-taxable bursary for a relative. This is called salary sacrifice. And who is doing this? It's employers who cannot afford to offer bursaries will make use of this incentive. So as an example, if you earn 240,000 Rand a year, and the tuition fees of your children are 20,000 Rand a year, you can say to your employer that you voluntarily sacrifice 20,000 of your salary. It's no longer yours. The employer will change that into a non-taxable bursary and commit that to the school, and that's an important fact. So you will then only pay tax on the 220,000. So because the 20,000 Rand is a non-taxable bursary, it reduces your tuition fees, and it commits the employee to the responsibility of paying. Once you've sacrificed it, it's gone, it's no longer your money. It goes from the employer to the educational institution if it's applied correctly. So as I mentioned in the quote, it's important to know who this affects because it's not only about the budget here. The users of this are majority black women, more than 74%. It's low earners, it's young children, and it's predominantly young employees. Furthermore, this has been so successful that in 2020, more than 150 million Rand has been channeled towards schools and committed to these schools because of this. Through COVID, it has been very robust. More than 4,000 schools receive funds because of this. Now, bear in mind, this might change if we change the law. So what is the latest proposal? The latest proposal in the T-Lab will make this bursary possible if any remuneration to which the employee was entitled or might in future become entitled to was in any manner whatsoever reduced or forfeited as a result of the grant of such scholarship or bursary. So this is not an amendment to the law, this is an effective closure of this completely. And important to quickly pause here and say, this effectively reverses the decision of salary sacrifice. That's the only thing that remains a discussion point at the moment. And once again, to go back to the initial page, one cannot say that salary sacrifice is an anomaly or a loophole because decisive action was taken to make it possible as an incentive. So then you've got to ask yourself the question, as you always do, and as in the first slide, what is the reason for this proposed change? So this question was asked to the Standing Committee, And National Treasury in response mentioned two things. One was a loss to fiscus. The second one was a concern around abuse and how this is implemented. On the first point, the loss to fiscus, the chair in standing committee asked National Treasury to please quantify the numbers. Unfortunately, that was never reported on, and neither was the extent of the benefits, which I'm highlighting today, Chair. So on the loss to fiscus, we've quantified this, and for the excess of 200 companies for who we do this, it's a mere 11.5 million, but it assists thousands of learners. So if loss to fiscus is small, one has to ask, but what is abuse then? As I mentioned, abuse cannot be salary sacrifice, which is what the current change suggests to close down. Examples of abuse could be paying parties that are third parties like bookstores that may not be schools, or simply restructuring or reclassifying ordinary remuneration, which is something that Treasury has mentioned. But it cannot be salary sacrifice. So if there are other things, how do we address the abuse? And this is the solution that we want to put forward. So we know that it impacts a very vulnerable piece of the population. So the question then arises, are there no other ways to address the concerns? And I'm almost done. There are three slides remaining. So the issue of abuse was mentioned, but no solutions were offered for this. So we'd like to put forward practical evidence of how abuse can be avoided. When we as a company help other companies to administer this, we do two very important things which are not required by legislation. Firstly, we only pay money over to educational institutions when it is registered with the Department of Education. So in other words, even though the law allows for any third party for books, transport, accommodation, it's really broad, to receive money, the way that we help companies administer this is to only pay to verified educational institutions with a department. That's the first measure. The second measure, and this differs with many of the schemes that are out there, is we only allow employers to pay the educational institutions directly, not through the employees. And let me present practical evidence, and then I'll conclude on how this actually mitigates abuse, which is the only remaining concern. Of the 200 employers, many of them large JSE-listed companies that utilize the benefits, practical evidence suggests that only 8,000 employees are using this. That's 40 employees per company. You can make your own conclusions as the committee on whether or not that is an abuse if only 40 employees per company use this. Of the employees who use it, they only upload 1.36 relatives on average. And we know the national average of relatives per employee is higher than that. So it's not like they're uploading multiples of relatives. Because of those two measures, they only upload relatives who actually make use of the benefits. And lastly, the law is very broad. It allows for any relatives in your family within 3 degrees, like nephews, nieces, uncles, aunts, to make use of this. But when those two measures are employed, 90% of the relatives that are used, and this is practical evidence, are sons and daughters. So there's no abuse there.
Yeah, you're exceeding 10 minutes by far now. You're on 11:40, but please finish.
My apologies, Chair. There's one slide left after this. I don't have to reiterate the point. These are the two measures that we have put forward with practical evidence that will address the concern, which is abuse. And this is the last slide, and I'll conclude. To summarize, National Treasury took decisive action in 2006 to make this an incentive. Further steps were taken to incentivize more people to make use of it by increasing the thresholds. The incentive has achieved exactly what it was set out to do. It's transformative and supports the right portion of the population. The consequence of the closure would be to take this away completely. So we're saying, instead of closing down the facility, consideration was not paid. So when it comes to children and education, we think we should consider this more deeply. And
okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you. You're at 12:29. That's 2.5 minutes more. Please, can we ask other people to stick by the agreed program? 10 minutes, please. Okay, next then is Saika. Thank you. Very clear, very precise. That was very good input. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Can you see my screen?
Yes, indeed.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for giving us the opportunity to comment again on these bills. We really do appreciate it, and I'll be quick and hopefully make up some of the time for you. We're only going to be discussing three topics, two of which we have discussed before or were included in the bills. We have discussed all of them before, but we're going to be highlighting the proposed changes. So the first one we're going to start off with is the Intention and Criminal Tax Offences Act. Now, the proposal initially was that willful conduct or intent for criminal offences was going to be taken out of the Act. That was now changed, and they've kind of linked it with negligence as well. But I think we want the committee to look to consider three questions, and we need to find the answers to these questions to come up with a proposed or proper solution. The first one, is intention a constitutional requirement for criminal matters? So must you have intent to be found guilty of a criminal offence? And the second one is, should minor administrative compliance failures be regarded as criminal offences? Because if it does, then you will have a criminal record, and that has a whole lot of further implications for that individual regarding employment, et cetera, et cetera. And the third one is, what standard of proof is there to avoid selective prosecution? So selective prosecutions is where, say, for instance, STARS has the ability to choose which of the offences they decide they want to actually prosecute. So if we look at the proposed changes, and we do appreciate National Treasury's changes, implementing the two different types of categories, which was one of our recommendations, so we're thankful for that. So the first category is where a person willfully either submits a false statement, obstructs a SARS official, or fails to reply truthfully, and there's a whole lot of other cases as well. So that is where there is actual intent. The person did this intentionally. And in that case, on conviction, that person will be liable to a fine or 2 years imprisonment. So there is criminal intent there. The second category is where the person fails to either willfully or negligently register for tax, change their address, submit a return, etc. So these are the second categories are for more the administrative offences that a taxpayer can incur. So again here, despite the fact that it was negligent, for instance, if found guilty on conviction, that person will be subject to a fine or 2 years imprisonment, meaning that person will have a criminal record as well. Sorry, I suppose I was meant to start my video, hey? All right, so our concern here is the second category, and that is the willful or negligently. So again, what is happening here is that if a taxpayer decides that or forgets to register or didn't know that they had to register, as the law currently reads, that person, if convicted, this will be a criminal offence, and that person will have a criminal record. So it seems that the bar for the second category is shifted a lot lower than the other one, where you actually have to prove intent. Here you just have to be negligent. And if found guilty, it will be a criminal offence. So our concern here is, and this is, we're linking it again back to the Constitutional Court, that found that before a person can be found guilty of a criminal offence, there must be willful intent. And this has to be proved by the state. So you've got to have not just negligence, there has to be intent and negligence. And then the relative gravity of the punishment must meet or reflect the gravity of the offence. So it can't be excessive for what you've done, and that's what we feel is currently happening. And there must be a reasonable mistake, must not result in criminal culpability. The second concern that we have, over and above this whole intent issue, is the selective prosecution. Now, what this means is that SARS has the right or has choice to decide whether or not it should be prosecute a taxpayer. Now, SARS is correct, and the response by National Treasury and SARS in the workshops, we realize SARS does not prosecute, it is the NPA that prosecutes. But the concern we have is not the prosecution. The concern that we have is that SARS is the one that can decide whether or not to send a case to the NPA for prosecution. So let's take, for instance, you have three different taxpayers all committed the same offence. SARS has three options. They can either do nothing to all of them, or they can decide to levy a civil sanction, a fine, whatever it may be, or they can decide to criminally prosecute these taxpayers. And it can decide that irrespective of who the taxpayer is, etc. So again, the concern here is not the prosecution, it's the fact that SARS has the choice to decide whether or not to send something for prosecution or how to levy a sanction at this stage. And this is concerning because SARS could be used as a political instrument or could be used to politicize certain taxpayers, and that's not what we want. We don't want SARS to be in that position or have that power. So that relates to our concern there. So what are our recommendations in this regard? Well, first of all, regarding the criminalization of simple cases of negligence, we need to, as the Constitutional Court said, align the punishment to the veracity of the transaction. So if it's a simple crime, it needs a simple punishment. So minor offenses should be subject to civil sanction only. Only if those minor offenses are repeatedly done, then can we say consider criminal prosecution. And of course, for criminal offenses, that has to be sanctioned with criminal court cases, etc. With regard to selective prosecution, so here we need to first of all make sure that we have consistent treatment for the same offense. We cannot have different taxpayers committing the same offense and having different penalties because of that. We need to compel SARS to be transparent on these prosecutions, and we need to also ensure that there is objective and clear standards of proof to compel them to refer this to the MPA. Now, we do recognize and agree with SARS that there is scarce criminal investigative resources currently in the country, but be that as it may, we need to ensure that we are consistent in what we are doing. And that's why it is so important for us that we need to really critically look at what are the criminal offenses. We cannot make minor offences criminal because, as the law currently stands, they should be compelled to be sent to the MPA. It's a criminal offence that needs to be reported. So our request here is to please go seriously consider what are criminal offences and make sure that SARS has the obligation to report these to the MPA so that they can be followed up. I mean, be that a million taxpayers.
Can you start rounding up, Sharon, please?
I will. Almost done. Thank you. The withdrawal from the retirement funds on immigration. So here the concern was that people were immigrating just to access their retirement funds. Now, again, our concern here is that this is not a simple thing to do. And we want to reiterate that this is it's the taxpayers' money that we are talking about here that SARS is trying to, or National Treasury is trying to keep here because they are saying that the people will become a drain on the fiscus should they sometimes return. Now, the concern, as we raised previously, is that this is not a simple thing to do, and we're not sure how they came up with the 3 years, so our suggestion on this would be to defer this whole process for 12 months to align it with the change in exchange controls and to discuss this further to come up with a better proxy other than the 3 years, a time period as such. And our suggestions there would be to use a change in residence to prove change in residence as well as to prove permanent residence in the other country. That should go a long way to saying that those people generally won't be coming back to South Africa. On the last one, Section 1010, again, you know, we really do thank National Treasury for bringing in the relief. So they've now changed the 183-day requirement to 117 days. So we do welcome that. However, our concern is that is not necessarily going to help everyone because it's not only the South African lockdown period that people were stuck here. They couldn't return. Even if they could get out of South Africa, they couldn't get into the other countries. They only have certain relief in respect of double taxation. The DTAs are also not helping them in certain cases. So just to make things simple for everybody, there's no loss to the fiscus. In general, these people would have been entitled to Section 1010 in any case. Disregard the presence of those people while they were working purely because of COVID. And also, please just remember that this is not only applicable to Section 1010. We've left out the officers and crew of ships, so we're not sure why that wasn't applied to Section 1010 as well. So please consider that. And it is causing some concerns in that regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now we have Philip Morris, 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Nitesh Ramji, and I would like to take this opportunity today to speak about the taxation of heated tobacco products that was announced for the first time in the budget speech in February this year. I had the opportunity to listen to the briefing given by National Treasury to the committee last week, and I think that at the outset I should just clearly differentiate what heated tobacco products are versus e-cigarettes because there may be some confusion. Heated tobacco products contain real tobacco and as such are regulated by the Tobacco Products Control Act 1993 as amended. E-cigarettes have a liquid that contains nicotine and are not yet regulated in the South African law. Heated tobacco products also, in terms of the World Customs Organization, got a new tariff heading, which was voted upon in Geneva. South Africa was one of the countries that voted in favor of that, so clearly distinguishing this product from cigarettes and e-cigarettes. And then also in the US, the Food and Drug Administration went through the science on our heated tobacco product proposition thoroughly over a number of years. And this year gave us the classification, the first such classification, as a modified risk tobacco product. So just to distinguish the product that we're talking about, I'll show a picture of it shortly as I bring up my screen. Just want to confirm, can you see the presentation?
Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
Thank you. So just by way of background, we did make a presentation to the Standing Committee in the National Assembly. In a very short presentation, basically we cited what the Minister of Finance said in the budget speech, that there would be a tax, the example of bubbly or shisha or hookah pipe, water pipe tobacco was used. And the confusion came in for us when we saw the rate, which was published as 815.63 per kilogram. So we read that to be a gross amount because net was written for water pipe tobacco or hubbly bubbly. And net is also used for things like cigars and pipe tobacco. So to get to the number 815.63, one has to calculate what is the value of the tobacco in a cigarette, an ordinary cigarette, per kilogram, and then minus 25% to get to the intention of the minister to give a concessionary rate. And as a result, we believe that there was a technical error here, that the word net had been omitted. We also saw that in the United Kingdom, the exact same issue came up where the word net was omitted. There was a public consultation. And as you can see in the underlined bits, clearly the weight of the tobacco itself is the most equitable system that can be implemented, and the change was made in the UK. Also, I experienced in 28 countries around the world that have the exact same taxation system like South Africa, fully specific, no ad valorem component. They all do it based on the net tobacco weight. And that is why we raised this issue initially with Treasury and with the committee in the National Assembly. There was a written feedback document which was given to the committee in the National Assembly. And what was stated there is that actually the intention of Treasury is to not tax these products based on weight, whether that's gross or net, but rather to move to a system next year, which is based on a set rand and cent value per stick. And they cited two examples of Hungary and Jordan. So the discussion point here is just to illustrate that there are issues when you go the route of taxing tobacco products based on the full weight of the stick, and this was clarified unequivocally in the briefing session that this committee received last week from National Treasury. And there is also an issue when you look at what National Treasury has said that they want to do going forward. And what we're trying to do is point out potential loopholes and just say, given our experience in multiple markets around the world, there must be a reason why the net tobacco weight has been chosen as the most efficient route for tax collection and also creating a level playing field for competition. So just to quickly jump onto the Jordan example that was cited by National Treasury, there they have a very low tax rate for these products. 80% differential versus conventional cigarettes. And they said, well, when these products get to 5% market share, then we can review. And that is a very practical system. But the problem, as I'll illustrate in the coming slides, is that when you go on a per stick basis, you're not dealing with apples for apples in this new category where there's a lot of emerging technology and a lot of new products coming from multiple companies, not just the traditional tobacco company. So this is our proposition. It's a heated tobacco product, tobacco stick, which comes in a pack of 20, and then it's put into a device where it's heated to 350 degrees, and it creates vapor and not smoke. And as a result, you expose yourself to a lot less harmful emissions. So it's not harmless, but it's less risky. when you look at other products which are available on the market, so all the major manufacturers have a proposition where it comes in a pack of 20, but you also get different devices where you have just a capsule, something that looks like a pod that you put into a coffee machine, or you have some kind of hybrid version where you've got liquids as well as some kind of tobacco pod, and then you get ones that have loose tobacco. So if you're going to do it on a per stick basis, here's a hypothetical example. You're going to have some manufacturers that have to pay for 20 units in a pack X size, but other manufacturers that will have three or five or whatever number, and these may be able to be used multiple times, so they're going to end up paying less revenue for a device that may give the same utility or a consumable that may give the same utility as our proposition, which comes in something which is in a pack of 20. Or how are you going to, if it's per stick, the taxation, deal with something which has loose tobacco, which is not in a stick form, not in a pod form, not in a unit form. So this is the issue that we're trying to highlight. So if you go on the net tobacco weight in any of these products, then revenue can be assured that they are going to receive the exact same amount of excise per kilogram. Doesn't matter what shape or form it comes in. If it's heated, per kilogram, you're going to get exactly the same amount of revenue. So that's why we feel that the precedent which has been set in many other countries should be followed here in South Africa, should be on the net tobacco basis, and not on the weight of the full stick, which was also acknowledged in the briefing to this committee last week, that there can be manipulation if somebody produces a lighter stick, then they're going to pay less revenue. So this is our submission for today, and we do believe that it's a difficult situation because the budget speech gets made in February, the taxes become immediately applicable, then we've got a long consultative process which takes us almost to the next budget. So we understand that Treasury has indicated what they want to do for the next budget, and we are pointing out an issue with that, giving the example of Jordan and Hungary, and saying how that system can be manipulated, but also the current system, which was clarified in the briefing last week, where it can be manipulated if somebody produces a lighter unit. What we are saying is that the middle ground should be adopted, where you take the common denominator and say, what's the weight of the tobacco for every kilogram that is consumed through heating? Exactly the same amount of revenue will be received by the fiscus. So that's all for me. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir. You're at 9 minutes, which is great. next would be research unit on the economics of excisable products. Thank you, whoever that is. Are you here?
Thank you very much, Chair. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Thank you, sir, for the opportunity to be able to speak to the committee. And I am the director of the research unit on the economics of excisable products. It is based at the University of Cape Town. We are researchers that look into specifically tobacco, alcohol, and sugar-sweetened beverages. We are economists by training. We have a strong public health focus, but we are not advocates as such. So we are not a lobby group as such, but we do research. Our funding comes primarily from international organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the International Development Research Center, and Cancer Research UK. So today I would like to make a presentation specifically motivating for a substantial increase on tobacco products in South Africa, based to some extent on the experience that we've had over the past 6 months in terms of the tobacco sales ban brought on by COVID-19. So of course the question is, why do we tax tobacco? tobacco have been levied for literally hundreds of years, and in South Africa we can go back to at least 1910 to see the excise taxes on tobacco products being levied. And there are basically two primary reasons for it. The first one is that of revenue generation, and we know that tobacco taxes are a very efficient source of revenue in any country. In many countries, the tax share relative to price is still relatively low. In South Africa's case, it's in the order of about 41% of the retail price. In terms of what the World Health Organization is proposing, they are proposing at least a 70% excise tax share in their countries, or in the countries on which they have got comment. Also, we know that the demand for these products is relatively price inelastic. So in other words, as the price increases, consumption drops, but consumption tends to drop at a lower rate than what the price increases by. And we also know that the number of producers producing tobacco products is relatively minor. In the case of South Africa, the market has become much more diversified over the past number of years as smaller companies have come into the market. But nevertheless, we don't have hundreds of companies producing cigarettes, but rather about 10 or 20 maximum. Of course, the public health measure or reason for taxing tobacco is very clear. And we know that tobacco is a very, very dangerous and even deadly product. But we also know that if people are faced with very high prices, they tend to reduce their consumption. So over the past year, on average, we find that 26,000 people die prematurely because of smoking. It's also what another rationale for taxing tobacco is to reduce the economic burden of tobacco use in society. A study that was recently published indicates that the cost of tobacco is in the order of about 42 billion rand. And if one compares that with the revenue that we receive, which is in the order of about 14 billion rand, clearly the two are not making sense, and there's a net negative impact on tobacco for society. And then of the last reason why we want to tax tobacco is to correct the market failure in tobacco use. And everybody knows that smoking is associated with negative externalities. People around smokers also get exposed, and that leads them to receive or possibly be exposed to all kinds of negative health outcomes. So in the past, or during the period of the sales ban, our unit conducted two online surveys. These surveys were conducted in May and in June, and I'll just refer primarily to our second survey, which attracted more than 23,000 responses. And what we found is that cigarette prices increased to an average of 114 rand per pack by June, which was probably the peak of the prices, although we don't actually know what happened after the 19th of June, but we suspect that the prices may have come down. But there were very significant price increases, something like 250% on average. Of course, that 250% average hides significant variation, and in some provinces, especially the Western Cape, the price increases were as high as 380% relative to pre-lockdown. So very, very large increases in the price of these illicit cigarettes that were sold during the sales ban period. If we asked, we asked our respondents, why did you quit? Why did you want to quit? And more than 50% of those respondents indicated that they had quit not because of health concerns, not necessarily because they wanted to follow the rules set by government, but more specifically because the product had become too expensive. And what we found is that our respondents were telling us what the international literature clearly shows, and that is an increase in the excise tax, an increase in the price of the product results in people wanting to reduce their consumption. And as you can see in this diagram, by far the most important reason was cigarettes have become too expensive during lockdown, and that was the reason why people wanted to quit smoking during this period. Right from the start, we knew that the sales ban was going to be temporary. It was never meant to be a permanent feature of the South African society. And we see that 91% of our smokers who did not quit smoking actually bought cigarettes on the illicit market. The illicit market greatly increased during this period. If one looks at the literature and if one looks at the experience of other countries, a sudden spike in the price of a product typically does not result in a huge decrease in consumption, because people tend to grin and bear it and they hope for better times to come. And in the case of South Africa's sales ban experience, that's exactly what happened. The sales ban went on for something like 20 weeks. People were quitting smoking, some of them, but most were not quitting smoking, because most smokers were under the impression and under the hope that the prices would reduce. And what we know from the international literature is, if prices increase on a consistent and a permanent basis, that tends to have a much bigger impact on consumption rather than a temporary spike in the price. The tobacco industry has had a differential experience during the lockdown. I think it would be fair to say that the local producers have generally benefited. The multinationals have typically found that this was a tough experience, as much of their market share was eroded away during this period. And I know that the multinationals specifically have asked for a moratorium on excise tax increases on the grounds that the illicit market is out of control. And the argument would typically go that the illicit market first needs to be under control before the government can raise the excise tax. We would argue that that is probably not the appropriate argument. It is very much self-serving and fallacious, given the tobacco industry's actions. And the actions of the tobacco industry was that very shortly after the sales ban was lifted, British American Tobacco announced that it would increase the retail price to recover some of the losses that they had incurred during the lockdown. By implication, what that suggests is that BAT had calculated that despite the existence of cheap brands and the illicit market, they would do better by raising the retail price and extracting a greater per cigarette profit from its customers. And basically what BAT was thinking was, we are willing to reduce some of our consumption, some of our market share, but we will increase our total profitability by increasing the per cigarette profit on cigarettes. So the question that one would then ask is, why would BAT increase the retail price of cigarettes and by implication increase the gap between their product and the cheap and illicit cigarettes, if the threat of the illicit market is so grave? If the illicit market was truly out of control and was undermining their market share, it would not have increased its price in the way that it has. So Chair, we would like to urge the selection committee to substantially increase the excise tax on tobacco products in the next budget cycle. Lives are at stake, and we know that an increase in the excise tax raises the retail price. It will encourage some smokers to quit smoking, but it will also increase government revenue. For both public health and for the fiscus, increasing the excise tax is very much a win-win situation. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for your time.
Thank you, sir. you were very good in time, 9.25. Okay, thank you. Now, excuse me, the committee secretary lets me know right now that there's a further application for by 12J to be included in the program. or is it we switched it around, because it's on the current program in Kululeko. This email that you sent me now, we do have 12J on the program. What is it you're suggesting? I don't follow.
No, Chair, I was just sent you a revised program that included S12J, because initially what I sent to members did not have
S12J. Oh, yes, I got that. That's the program I'm working on. Thanks, Nkululeko. I expected it this morning. So it is the latest program. Okay, good. That's settled. Now over to the members. Questions, comments, contributions, whatever. Thank you to all the people who made submissions. Very good submissions overall. Right, let's go for it. Who's first? Nkululeko, help me here. I'll look at the, any hands up? Yes, there's a hand up there. Dennis. Dennis is there, I see. Yeah, Dennis so far. Anybody else? Not yet. Okay. Go for it, Dennis.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning. Chair, yes, I think we've had excellent presentations so far today. As you said, it's unusual that we have so many, and maybe there was a question mark at the beginning, but having looked at the content, I think we've had excellent presentations. So I'm going to go in order. Mr. Liebenberg, your presentation was excellent. Now, I clumsily raised this issue without having much of the facts and information behind it at the presentation when the bill was presented. But I think Mr. Liebenberg has made some fantastic points, and I really believe that he's made a strong argument in this case. I can't see any counter-argument coming from Treasury. I look forward to them trying to justify their position. I think an excellent presentation, cogently put, concise, and well done. I do agree with you. I think that the two arguments of a loss of fiscus and abuse have been totally disproven and overstated by Treasury and all SARS. So well done on that. Dr. Smulders, I think, yes, again, good points. You make the point that I'm also worried about, and it seems that Treasury and SARS have kind of gone into conspiracy theorists realm, and they've developed some sort of paranoia, and maybe using the old story of using a sledgehammer to kill a mosquito, but treating everyone as if they are on the wrong side of the law, when in fact they're not. So again, just a comment, Dr. Smulders, thank you for your presentation. Mr. Ramji as well, I think net is the norm. You made your point. I'm not a big understander of that. I think my colleague, Mr. Oakamp, will have more understanding on that, and I'll leave it to him. In terms of REAP, Professor, I'm not sure that you convinced me with your arguments, and you drew some conclusions that I don't necessarily agree with. My point is that I think you've lost this round, Professor. But I do urge you to correspond with us over the next 6 months or whatever until we get to, well, I suppose 3 months, until we get to the February situation. Send us a little bit more information to help win us across, because I really don't feel that you've done enough today to justify, saying that because tobacco users are willing to pay more, we must tax them more. I question that. It's almost like, I'm not even going to say what I was going to say. But I mean, it's just a case of, here's something, let's milk it as hard as we possibly can. I hear the health benefits and so on. I also hear the fact that people have freedom of choice. And I think we need to balance the whole lot together. Please send us an email, talk to us a little bit more, but you haven't won my heart today, that's for sure. Thank you, Chair.
who's Willie, are you coming in? When he speaks about his heart, Professor Van Welbeck, he's speaking of his own heart, not the collective heart of the committee, obviously, but he's entitled.
That's fine.
Yeah, no, that's the way you say. No, you have every right to say what you say, and I empathize with some of the things you're saying. But when you say you haven't won our except, I don't know what word you'd, you're talking about yourself and your party, probably, yeah. But, actually, I would ask members to be kindly cautious, not that Dennis said anything he's not entitled to or should have, but, we must hear Treasury and hear both sides. One thing that's very clear, Yanga, is that from your presentation last week and the quality and nature of the inputs today, there is quite a gap, more than often happens. Now, Yanga, don't give us the famous National Treasury line. Nobody wants to pay taxes, right? Of course we know that. Okay, let me not say anything more for now. I will come in when I come in, which is now Willie's turn. I think Willie, I'll come. You were supposed to come in. Where are you? Are you here?
I am here. Thank you, Chair. It's good to see you again. Chair, yes, thank you. Mr. Liebenberg, I'm also going to start with you. I have mostly been covered by my colleague, Mr. Ryder. I really think that that was an excellent presentation that really set out the steps that were taken in the past and made it understandable to each and every one of us. My opinion on this is that education is most certainly one of the biggest driving issues that we must drive in this country, because education is the future of everybody in this country. And I believe by doing what you have suggested here today will improve the education system as a whole. It will improve the opportunities that individuals will have. We've got a situation here where an incentive is given when education is being paid. You cannot subtract that if you are not paying for that education. That means that the burden of government is lessened by people paying for education of people in need. So we will most certainly be in full support of that. And thank you so much for a very well presented presentation. I really appreciate that. With regards to Mr. Ramji, we asked the questions about 2 weeks ago. And for me, it's a matter of, I think we must compare apples with apples. We must not have a situation where one product is taxed in a certain way and another product is taxed in a different way. I understand the way in which you said that it must be done on the weight per tobacco or the tobacco in a product. That clearly makes sense to me. You can, and this is my question, can you get to a situation where if the stick is measured, weighed, or if the whole packet is weighed, that people or companies can sacrifice on quality of filtering of those cigarettes? In other words, to make it lighter, they can work around and make a poorer quality filters that at the end of the day will have an effect on the net weight of the whole product. Whereas if they only weigh the tobacco, you weigh tobacco of product A, you weigh tobacco of product B, and you tax them on that. Obviously, that is a better thing, because I think one has seen over the past that they, you get cigarettes with a good quality filter and you get cigarettes with an absolute poor packaging and poor quality of filtering. That is my question to you. Then to Reap, I agree with my colleague, Mr. Ryder. I don't think that you have convinced me. In actual fact, what you said here today is that cigarettes soar with between 250 to even 300% in pricing. Yet 91% of the people that you spoke to said that they did not quit. All that happened was that people that smoked all of a sudden paid huge amounts more for their cigarettes, whereas they had quite less money available for other basic needs. We must remember that nicotine and cigarette smoking is an addiction. People are not easily going to leave it. And that is what we saw during this lockdown. Normally you get price increases of 5 to 10% per annum. All of a sudden you had between 250 and 300% price increases, and not even that on a short term prevented 91% of people to stop smoking, or help them to stop smoking. So I don't really think that that argument will work. I think that by excessively taxing smoking, we will see other social problems coming to the front instead of people quitting smoking. Most smokers did not quit. The illicit cigarette market made a huge amount of money. We all know that. And I think that needs to be regulated better in order for South Africa to receive a better income. Thank you very much, Chairperson. That covers what I want to say.
Okay, sorry, Zolani Mkiva wants to say something, but he got cut off. Is he back? Okay, when Zolani comes back, is there anybody else in Kululeko that you picked up? Sorry. Zolani?
Are you there?
Yeah.
Can you hear me, Chair?
Thank you. Yes, we can see you too.
Yeah, Chair.
Very smart shirt.
With regard to the first presentation on bursaries, my first question, Chair, is really based on the issue of those bursaries. I hear the point of the presenter, and I appreciate what he says in this regard. But you see, it's easier said than done in this issue of bursaries. If these bursaries can ensure that they have a wide reach and consider geographical spread as well as a transformational approach into the historical discourse of the country, it would make more sense for me to sort of have an inclination to support the ideal of a further consideration of what they are pleading for. But I would like to ask a question specifically on that regard. Are they really making it a point that these bursaries are creating a game changer in the course of ensuring that they really support the historically disadvantaged people? Because it is only through that we can really point at them. Because remember that they are the one who issues the bursaries. They identify the candidates and they do everything else. And sometimes they can outsmart, us, because it's something that they do on their own. There's no one else who's providing oversight in terms of what they do in the issuance of those bursaries. I really like it, because really he makes a strong point that we need to separate the matters in terms of money issues and the issues that the actual role of the bursary and education, to be specific, the role that education plays in society, which is very key, because education is an instrument of social transformation. But it would really make sense to me that if those bursaries were really creating a necessary change and ensure that we spread them across, and if the bulk of them would really be going into the historical disadvantaged communities. That is my first question. The second question, year on year, Chair, and this one relates to the issue of tobacco. I understand the point that overtaxation could lead to all sorts and manner of things. But we must agree, and I think they should agree, that in order for us to have a healthy society or a wealthy society, the issue of tobacco needs to be re-looked at. We cannot continue to proceed to support it just for the sake of it, because it provides jobs. We need to strike a balance, Chair. And I think they need to help us that what is their long-term view, because they need to look at other mechanisms, so that we cannot promote the issue of smoking, because we know what damage it does. It creates an unhealthy society, and therefore I think they ought to think out of the box now to see how they can even diversify their business and so on and so forth, in order for us not to continue year by year listening to the justification on why we should not increase the tax on tobacco, and yet we do know the consequences of smoking and so on and so forth. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Zolani. Just for those of you from the stakeholder side who may not understand this, in Kosi and Kiva, like other members who have their bases, traditional homes in rural areas, do not have the service, signal service, that we who live in urban areas do. So and they have interrupted connections. So the Chief Whip's office has requested, and they themselves have done this, that they move out of their homes for the duration of a meeting and find a signal. So you will find sometimes members are in a car. It's not because they're shopping, or in Kosi and Kiva's having an imbizo or something with his traditional community. It's because presumably he's got no choice and so on. But thank you there, Zolani. Is there anybody else in Kuleleko who wants to raise things in the meanwhile?
No, Chair.
Okay. We'll come back on those issues tomorrow. But firstly, let me start with that. You see, I hadn't anticipated, well, it hasn't happened since, as Dennis says, since May last year, that we've had so many submissions on tax bills on our side. So I took it that we could, get National Treasury's response tomorrow and move on. But clearly, Yanga, it's not going to happen. We cannot proceed according to our original intent. I'm just, well, Njalo's still there. I'm just coming from a meeting of the chairpersons of committees on the NCOP side, and it's been made clear that Parliament, which means the NCOP side, which is always rising a week after the NA, will definitely rise on the 9th, okay? So we don't have much time. Moreover, I need to alert the stakeholders to this because they may not know it. We do as members. Unfortunately, because of the small size of the NCOP, we are only 60 permanent members compared to 400 on the other side. Members have to serve in more than one committee. And in our case, all of us on the Finance Committee are also in the Appropriations Committee. So we have to deal also with the Division of Revenue bills and the appropriation bills and the tax bills, all of which have to be passed before the 9th by the same people. So for the stakeholders to understand that we're sitting this afternoon, I think from 3 o'clock in appropriations, we're sitting tomorrow in this committee and in appropriations, we're sitting on Thursday and on Friday, and I think almost every day next week. So clearly we will not finish this tomorrow, and we will have to rejuggle our program. And we will have to make more time for the Finance Committee, which is effectively also the Appropriations Committee. Young, are you listening, right? So Treasury is going to be very busy with us. The second thing to say is that Yanga and your team, I think Chris is here. Momo's not here, is he, Yanga?
Hi, Chairperson. I want to apologize. Momo is not here. He is in Standing Committee on Finance together with France. And the commissioner and the deputy minister, they are doing the new gen report.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's fine. But, you know, I'm asking because, Yanga, you need to brief him. And you need to go through these submissions. And unfortunately, you know, it's nobody's fault. We in the NCOP achieved off also, but this is the way Parliament works. And it's difficult because you guys also took one extra week to bring the MTBPS. But again, we are empathetic and sympathetic. I mean, COVID came 102 years after the previous pandemic. So everybody has to be understanding. But Yanga, may I say, as the leader of your team, that, you know, on the whole, these submissions are quite compelling, which doesn't mean I agree with them personally. I'm not ready to decide that. I'll do a lot more reading. But they're quite good, Yanga. I mean, you know, so what I would like to suggest in the first place, Yanga, is that you guys must get to work, right, tracking. We want good replies to these things, concrete, precise replies. Secondly, the stakeholders, you are free, as happens on the NA side, we didn't expect this to be what it has come to be, to respond to National Treasury. The third thing I have to say, again, this is beyond my control. Some of you who know me may know that I chaired the Local Government Committee from 1998 to 2004 in this parliament. And tomorrow and on Thursday, there's the 25 years of local government conference. Now, I had agreed some weeks ago to speak, and the understanding was going to be in the afternoon. But in any case, that clashes with the Appropriations Committee. So either way, we're going to lose out. So I hadn't known the Appropriations Committee will meet in the afternoon. And moreover, I don't want to bore you, but they put me on the wrong topic. So I have to speak at and I can't get out of it. And in fact, I don't want to get out of it because it can be done and our meeting tomorrow can go ahead. And frankly, who's around left here from that era of 1994? And I did chair the committee. They want to know what are the politics of the local government system, not the system, what underpinned some of the decisions we took. And how do I see it as the chair of the committee at that time from this vantage point? So I can't escape that. It's my responsibility to do it. So we have discussed this with Dennis, and Fanny explained to Dennis and Simon, and I spoke to him in charge of the web, that he unfortunately is having to sacrifice the meeting, but it's fine. We thank him for that. So the meeting tomorrow is not from 9 to 12, the conventional time, it's from 11 to 2. It's been approved by the web and so on the NCOP side. So please note, stakeholders, you are free to come tomorrow, well, come in the virtual sense, and you are free to respond within limited period. So let's hear National Treasury tomorrow, which is why I said, Dennis, I can only as a chair say all of us, including me, should be cautious, because then Treasury will come with compelling arguments. And of course, they too will take all of the compelling arguments. So I would hope that we would look at both sides in a measured, balanced way. So bearing in mind that they did go to the NA with these proposals, and it's 75 bill, but it doesn't absolve us from giving full attention to their concerns and scrutinizing carefully what the NA has done. That's our job. So firstly, dealing with some concrete issues, I thought Smart Funder was quite compelling, Younger. I didn't know, Mr. Liebenberg, about the salary sacrifice issue and so on. Why would I? I mean, I'm not a tax expert. I'm just a mere politician, and this is not my area of expertise. I've never hidden that. But where in the world do you always get chairpersons of finance who are tax experts themselves? But we do lean on our staff and other experts. And so it's not as if we disempowered altogether compared to people who are technically competent like you and others who have spoken here. So, Younger, first thing you could do is respond to their concern, which they raised in the NA Smart Funder. What is the estimated loss to the fiscus? They're saying 11.5 million. I'm sure you're going to come with a different figure, as invariably happens. Maybe this time both of you agree. Secondly, they've offered ways of dealing with the abuse. Was this raised on the NA side? Did you reply to it? If so, what was your reply? If not, give us a reply to that tomorrow. There's nothing stopping you from replying today if there's time at the end. Then on SAICA, on the issue of criminal intent, I thought that was a very reasonable argument. The withdrawal of the pensions, they're saying defer it for 12 months. Can you say a bit more about why that's not possible, Younger? On 117 days, I was less compelled, but maybe well, you'll have to reply. On the matter of heated tobacco versus e-cigarettes, look, I don't know enough, really, and I can't take a personal view now, as an individual member of this committee, not as a chair, because I don't know enough. But if the gentleman's correct, then, you know, the norm seems to be that you don't use the, you must use the weight of the stick, and don't use the weight of the stick, but the weight of the grass, right? Now, all of these things, Yaga, could not have occurred to hands up those in this committee could work all that out. So I will read this submission like I'll read others to get a better understanding over the next 48 hours. I'll start this evening. But because it's impossible, by the way, Mondays are political days, and these things come so late. In Sunday, we had only one request for oral submission. So anyway, and Esther and Poppy, can you also... like realize that your responsibilities have become very onerous now, given all these submissions. So you'll have to look again at your summary, and you'll have to help the committee also to get a technical understanding. We will, of course, make the policy decisions. So in general, I don't hide this, I've said it before, many of us in the ANC, and myself in particular, are uneasy about the cost of tobacco and smoking and the like. It's something I express as an individual, but it's not something that prevails over the majority. My own views broadly mirror that of the ANC, but I think I am more ill at ease than other members are, and they will decide as a majority, and the committee will decide as a majority. Professor Van Welbeck is the least self-serving. That's why I instinctively, not always, but instinctively tend to take more seriously what you say, Professor. Of course, I'm acutely aware, as we all are, that people get funded for their research, and there seems to be a remarkable propensity for the researchers, not always, of course, to come up with conclusions that are reasonably consistent with what the funders, the private sector companies themselves, have as objectives and goals. I'm not saying that about you, Professor. In fact, I doubt very much, in fact, altogether, not very much, that this, well, I don't know, there's no proof, and I have no reason to pursue any questions about that. So I found what you're saying overall, let me put it this way. I identify with the value that underpins your work and your views and the views of REAP. I identify with that. But about the practicalities, you know, about the things Olani also said, we have the same problem, Professor, as you know, on the sugar beverages tax, health promotion levy. We raised it last week. That, you know, we most of us in the ANC, and I certainly, you know, and your colleagues that brought the most brilliant, you know, those of you who are not here last year, probably the finest submissions that I have ever come across since the early part of the first term of parliament. We're from excellent academics from South Africa. What was remarkable also was the demographic representation of the academics. They were young, maybe African, people of color generally, but it doesn't matter at the end of the day. We look at the substance of what people say, not simply the color of their skin. And they were really brilliant, Professor. And really, you know, on day one, they'd almost, Tandi said, Tobias Pokola said the same thing I felt, but I couldn't say it then. That actually they won the debate. We just couldn't, we didn't need the WHO here. So Professor, I am broadly empathetic with what you're saying, but hey, you know what? We have trade-offs. We have to think about jobs. We have to think about, this is right, the right to choose. I think the health department and others should do far more to make people politically aware. So it's more a choice than, you know, but also choices, I'm clear, Dennis, we can discuss this, class related. I mean, you know, working class people, unemployed, you know, marginalized people look for escape, you know, from their conditions. Through various means, okay, false prophets or smoking or, you know, ganja or drugs or whatever. So it's also class related. The middle class person like me can choose. But I don't think the choice is something. So, you know, this isn't the purview. This isn't the forum to discuss it, but it is very complicated. Professor, maybe you want to answer me a question. Would it be true to say that the number of deaths and the number of health problems are disproportionately among people of lower income status in this country? Is there any class analysis done? I mean, is it the case that proportionately working class people, unemployed, marginalized people, though they've got nothing, of course, they will buy a cigarette, are disproportionately smoking also? If you've got those statistics, great. If you don't have them, if you can let us have it within 24 hours, that doesn't mean, Professor Van Baalbek, that we're going to make a decision solely on those considerations. And let me stress again, I'm just one member in this committee. I every time now and then on big policy issues, not every time, at times, half the time, I get defeated by my own party. But that's what I have to say. Thank you. Over there, let's start with Smart Funder, who seems to have the best argument so far that I can see, compared to what we heard from Treasury on the input last week. Thank you. Okay, smart funder, Mr. Liebenberg. Can we stick to 2 to 3 minutes? And remember, nothing stops you from writing short replies to us. Don't flood us with reading, because really, you know, it's unfair. We're not the British Parliament or the Swiss Parliament or something. We're an emerging democracy. And we've got, as I explained, the same people on both committees. So remember, all of you, you can give short replies, you know, bullet points, points you couldn't make. So can I suggest each of you have 2 minutes, maximum three.
Perfect. Thank
Go
you
ahead, Mr. Liebenberg. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Firstly, thank you very much for everyone's willingness to listen to us. It's a great show of a democracy if the public is willing, you know, the opportunity to participate in this. I think by and large, it feels like the honourable members have heard the point that we want to bring across. And I also want to reiterate the fact that we're here to and willing to participate and help look for a solution to keep the straight incentive going. That's the intent behind our participation. I think the most pertinent question that we got was from Honorable Nkiba around whether or not this has the desired effect on the transformative nature across geographical areas. I can absolutely confirm, Honorable Nkiba, that that is the case. As highlighted in the presentation, more than 74% of the users of this product are Black females. I can share with you from personal stories that many of them are single mothers. I've got in excess of 800 testimonials, which I'm happy to share with you from these individuals. And I can also confirm that we have schools in the most rural of places who receive the money. Given the demographic of this and the fact that the people earn are lower income earners, the majority of the users, it's public schools that receive the money by and large. Happy to share the data with you. So in short, to answer your question, it certainly is a transformative piece of legislation. It does reach geographically wide. And I'd also like to state the point that nothing stops public servants, as an example, from utilizing this benefit. And we would absolutely advocate, for this to be offered to public servants. It doesn't happen at the moment, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we can't do that. And it could significantly reduce something like the burden that has been placed on NSFAS. Just a quick reply there, and very happy to further consult on that.
If I can just say, if you want to win in Nkosi Mkiba's heart, you can't just mention Black women. He wants to know which geographical location. He is concerned as a good traditional leader would be, never mind his differences of mind or certain things. So rural areas, my friend, he wants to know, and he's right. Do people from rural areas benefit? I know what you're going to think underneath it. Unfortunately, the results from your examinations favor people in the urban areas. So even if you're referring to Africans, you can maybe, if you can't do it now, tell us or tell him in particular about the community, what percentage, you may not have exactly a broad ballpark figure, is that the word? What percentage are from rural areas, whether it's men or women, or both actually,
It's a very good question, Honorable Chair. Unfortunately, I don't have the statistics offhand, but I will be certain to submit that and come back to you with that. But I can tell you, we have schools in rural areas that I've never heard of, in rural Limpopo, rural KZN, Mpumalanga, there's many representations. So it's absolutely geographically dispersed. And then the last comment I want to make, just to clarify, we don't choose who receives the bursaries. Companies offer this to their staff, and it's absolutely elective and anyone can apply. So if you have a company with a branch in a rural area in a rural province, they absolutely can apply, and it's something that we push for, is to make this equitable for anyone to apply. But I just want to clarify that we're not the decision makers. We simply help the company to offer this to the employees.
Okay, we have to round up. Yeah, you can send us half a page or a page of bullet points if you want, and you can certainly come tomorrow. So when you hear Treasury, we'll give you a chance to reply. Okay, Saika is next, Sharon. Anything? So, and you engage with Treasury endlessly, so you can be briefer, surely.
Thank you. Yes,
I didn't mean it literally. What I mean is we see you so much, unlike Mr. Liebenberg, I haven't seen.
No problem. Thank you, Chair. No, thank you for the comments. I mean, there weren't many, and I do just want to highlight again, that SARS and National Treasury should be focusing on the criminal offences. I think that's where the focus should be, and we don't want negligent, mistakes to be criminalised. I think that's the bottom line, and that definitely does need to be addressed. We can't let that go through. On the other one, the retirement funds, again, I just want to say that, it just again seems to be that Treasury is penalising everyone because they don't trust certain individuals, and a few people are making the mistake, or so they say. We don't have the figures there either, so it would be quite nice to get the figures from National Treasury on that. To say who are these people that are, willy-nilly changing their immigration status to take their funds with them. Because as far as I know, it's definitely not an easy process or a cheap process to do. You said the 1010 is not, so important. But the concern we have there is that, we put it in all our submissions because it wasn't there originally. It only came out in this last bill. So we never had chance to even, comment on the proposed changes. And like I said, we are very thankful for the changes. But again, like the other countries, we can't just look at the South African situation. We need to look a bit broader. It wasn't just South Africa that was locked down. The other countries were locked down too. So, you know, these people are going to be penalized. They're going to have, you know, interest and penalties, registration costs, and it's just all unnecessary. You know, if they are going to get, you know, exemption or refunds at the end, why go to all that trouble where we could have just sorted this out right from the word go and given certainty to these taxpayers? But that's all from my side. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sharon. Firstly, I didn't say I don't think the 170 days is important or are important. What I meant to say, if I did say it wrongly, is that I don't know what my position is. I don't know. It's the first time it's been raised in the committee. I can't say yes. The other two seem, the criminal intent issue seems reasonable at this stage, right? Until I hear them, I have to hear them. Secondly, yeah, you're right. If they have figures, National Treasury Younger, if you have figures, make them available to the committee about people who are falsely making a case for the need to withdraw their pensions because they, you know, leaving the country permanently when they're not intending to, or whatever permutation of that is false. Okay, thank you very much. Then we go to the heated tobacco versus e-cigarette story. Mr. Ramji, I think.
Mr. Ramji. Thank you, Honorable Okum, for your question. You are right on one front in that if a manufacturer manipulates the shape or form of the consumable of a heated tobacco product, then you can end up paying less tax, and that's the issue that we're pointing out. So we are saying that if the tax is based on the net tobacco weight, then you're going to have equity amongst any shape or form of heated tobacco product that may come out. It's a brand new category. The technology is emerging, and they're all different shapes and forms that are being launched globally, and we're starting to see new products being introduced in South Africa. When it comes to the quality of the product, which I think you were alluding to in terms of the filter, I can't comment on other people's products, but what I can say is that, as I mentioned before, our particular heat not burn proposition has gone through fine-tooth comb at the Food and Drug Administration in the US. We were the first such product to qualify, and still the only such product in this category to qualify for the classification of a modified risk tobacco product. And what we would welcome is that when the tobacco control laws get amended in Parliament, and there's been a lot of talk about the law being either repealed or amended, it will come to the Health Portfolio Committee in the National Assembly in due course, that a similar type of system gets implemented, that the science and the evidence is checked. And if a product is shown to be lower down on the spectrum of risk versus a conventional cigarette, that they should qualify for a different dispensation. And I think this also goes to Honorable Nkiva's question. This is exactly what we are doing. We are developing a portfolio of what we call reduced risk products to provide alternatives to cigarette smokers. So our position is clear. We say this all over the world, that if you haven't started using tobacco products, don't start. If you can quit, you should quit. But if you can't quit, then what we are saying is switch to a less harmful alternative, and do one which is based on science and evidence and get the proper information to make an informed choice. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir. Basically, to put it crudely, your argument is, okay, even if a person is opposed to tobacco smoking for its health and other consequences, surely this is a more amenable to them, since smoking is not going to be suddenly evaporated, right? So go for the less harmful or more healthy option. So that's your case to somebody who may have severe reservations, if not opposition, to tobacco smoking. That's your argument, basically, right? Okay. Secondly, the committee needs to apply its mind to whether there's a scientific basis for saying that. I don't know how we're going to do all of this before we vote on this next week sometime. And we have to, colleagues, because the ninth week, the Sunday before the ninth, we have to, before then, we have to table our report for Parliament to vote in the House. Okay, we hear you. Maybe Professor Van Velbeck wants to reply to what Mr. Ramji said, because we do encourage a dialogue. You know, it's not like a conveyor belt system. You come here, make your input, we ask you questions, and you go. We encourage, dialogues between labor and business, between traditional leaders and feminists, and so on and so on. So you want to say something quickly, yes?
Yes, I'll be very brief.
Go ahead.
Whether or not the Committee of Treasury views these products to be different, that's a separate matter of science and evidence. I think what I'm making a submission on today is a point and a revenue generation point. So the potential for evasion exists if the tax is based on the full weight of the stick, because you can create a lighter stick or a lighter product.
I heard that,
And separately, obviously, there are other issues that I've highlighted. So net gives equality and equity and a level playing field across the board.
Yeah, no, I heard you, but I'm just saying addressing a particular constituency that cuts across political parties from the extreme right to the extreme left, I'm sure, that's an additional argument, but your main argument is exactly what you said. No, I think the committee on it, you were very clear. But Professor Van Velbeck, maybe you want to reply to that, and so will the National Council Against Smoking. And we'll give you a space either today or tomorrow to reply to them as well. Thank you. Okay, over to you, Professor.
All right, thank you very much. I hope you can see me. We often disagree with the tobacco industry on multiple things, but the one thing that I would agree with Mr. Ramji is the following, and that is if you haven't smoked tobacco products, then don't start. And if you do smoke, then cut down or try and quit. I think on that one, we are in complete agreement with the presentation by Mr. Ramji. And it's a fact that most people regret that they started smoking cigarettes. Most people, in fact, research has shown that up to 80% of people are regretful regarding that. Also, if we have a look at what has happened to smoking prevalence over time in South Africa, at the moment, our best estimates are that approximately 20% of people are smoking cigarettes. Of course, more men than women. And there are also racial differences in terms of smoking prevalence. But in the early 1990s, that percentage was 32%. So over a period of time, either through people not starting to smoke, or specifically where people have been able to quit smoking, we see that there's been a significant decrease in smoking prevalence. Sadly, that smoking prevalence over the past 10 years have remained pretty much constant at around 20%. The main reason for that being is that the excise taxes have only increased very marginally in line with inflation, but not by much more. And we see that the trend that we saw from the early 1990s up to about 2008, 2010 has actually been stabilized, and we see that there has not been a further decrease in this smoking prevalence. We also know that an increase in the excise tax and an increase in prices has got a very significant impact more on young smokers, because they tend to be more cash constrained, they are less addicted, and they tend to be more responsive to an increase in the price of cigarettes. In other words, increasing the excise tax, which increases the price, is going to result in fewer people initiating smoking prevalence. What we also saw during the lockdown in our survey is that the different groups have responded quite differently to an increase in the prices that was caused by this artificial situation of legal cigarettes becoming banned. And we saw specifically that poor people have been able to quit significantly more than rich people. In terms of your question, Chair, regarding what is the prevalence of smoking in South Africa at the moment, our best estimates at the moment indicate, and our best statistics indicate, that the number of people who are poor have actually reduced quite significantly over time. The number of relatively more well-off people have been also decreasing, but not to the same extent. Why? Because poor people tend to be, like young people, more price sensitive to a change in the price. In terms of the argument about employment, one never wants to minimize employment arguments given our excessive unemployment rate in South Africa. But if one looks at tobacco production in South Africa, the number of farmers that are producing tobacco is relatively small. I think something like 160 commercial farmers, a number of emerging black farmers, but we are not nearly in a situation like in Zimbabwe, where literally hundreds of thousands of farmers are farming with tobacco. At most, we've got a few hundred as opposed to thousands of farmers. In the production of cigarettes, a number of companies fully import the cigarettes in South Africa. The biggest producer of cigarettes in South Africa is British American Tobacco. And from our understanding, they employ between 2,000 and 3,000 people in their factory in Heidelberg. So the point is that not all that many people are involved in the production of tobacco products. So I don't think that the argument of we should be thinking very much about employment compared to, on the other hand, 26,000 people dying on an annual basis from tobacco-related diseases, that balance is completely out of sync. And I think we should take cognizance of the fact that the health burden is very, very significant. Chair, I think that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Over then to National Council Against Smoking.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just start sharing.
Are you here? National Council Against Smoking.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Sharon Nyatanza. Okay, my name is Sharon Nyatanza, and I'll be presenting on behalf of the National Council Against Smoking, and hopefully I'll pick up some of the points where Professor Van Walbeck left off as well. So our submissions really are just basically also restricted to, you know, the proposed increases on tobacco products. And for today, I would like to specifically focus on the increases on the conventional, traditional tobacco cigarettes. So the rest bill proposes an increase of 8.70 per pack of 10 cigarettes, which is about an increase of 74 cents per pack of 20 cigarettes. So this, from our side, has been concerning because we have seen a downward trend in the increase of tobacco products over the years. So you see in 2018, there was an increase of about 1.22 rand per pack of 20, and this went down in 2019 to 1.14 rand. And now for 2020, we see an even a lower suggested increase on tobacco taxes of only 74 cents per pack of 20. So, you know, our argument is tax increases are very important. They're a very key part of tobacco control, but these can only make an impact if they are substantial. So you see here for an average smoker who smokes about 9 cigarettes a day, the proposed increases translate to about 122 rand per year, or, you know, 33 cents a day for 9 cigarettes smoked a day. And this increase does not really impact on affordability, because for tax increases to actually make a difference, they have to actually to impact affordability. And another concern is if the increases are very, you know, marginal, tobacco companies actually tend to absorb the increases, and then they actually won't be, you know, real price increases in the tobacco products. So the concern really is that the World Health Organization, the WHO, recommends, you know, that countries must actually impose taxes equal to 70 to 75% of the retail price. And in South Africa, right now, products are only being taxed at about 41.4%. And when we add VAT, which is about 15%, we're still about 55% of the retail price goes to taxation. And we're still substantially below the WHO recommendation under the Framework Convention on Tobacco Products, which we actually are a party to, and we are mandated, you know, under this convention to actually try and move towards the 70 to 75%. Percent tax increases. So while we won't reach there in a day or in a year, we are supposed to be actually making strides to go, you know, to move towards that mark. And right now we are still way below, and there's still room. So argument is there's still room for actually, you know, for there to be actually marginal, you know, for there to be large increases in tax. So the World Bank also it supports the issue of tobacco taxation. And, you know, their proposition really is that it's a win-win, like Professor Van Walbeck already said. It's a win-win for the health, but it's also a win-win for the economy. And currently, tobacco harm in the country is very high. 42 billion rand is lost each and every year to the South African economy from deaths, you know, from diseases, from lost productivity. And these are all related to tobacco-related diseases and harms. and only about 13 billion is received from tobacco excise taxes. So in the 2019 to 2020 tax year, we only received about 12.5 billion in taxation. And so there is still a large deficit that is currently witnessed in this area of tobacco. And our suggestion is that we should increase tax to try and offset some of this harm, which actually is being subsidized, therefore, by the taxpayer in the country. So, talking more about, tobacco harm, why it should be a concern, is the recent, for example, the NCD burden, which is currently unsustainable. So it is estimated that, the economic cost of ill health, for Africa was 6.7% in 2015, and it's estimated that it will go to 7% by 2030. And it is very important to understand that, tobacco actually consumption and also even exported secondhand smoke is linked to the onset of the four major non-communicable diseases like the heart disease and the cancer diseases. But it's not only the NCDs. Tobacco is also linked to worse outcomes for the communicable diseases, which the country is currently, struggling with. So you see that for TB cases, 20% of TB cases actually related to the use of tobacco or exposure to tobacco. And you see that for TB treatment, the use of tobacco actually makes it less effective. The same is seen for HIV with ARVs. When one is exposed to tobacco, these actually are less effective as well. So you see that the burden that tobacco causes is very large, and it actually impacts each and every one of us, because it basically impacts the general health of the country. So we are really arguing that when we increase taxes, we actually are basically improving health, and we're saving in public funds as well. So recently now, since we're in the context of COVID-19, I thought it would also be very important to say that COVID-19 not only, reiterated the importance of public health to every sector, not only to the public health department, but even to the whole, to the whole economics of the country as well. So as we see, tobacco is linked to worse COVID-19 outcomes, and this actually also reiterates the need to turn the tide on the tobacco epidemic. And as I said earlier, tobacco is linked to NCDs. And in South Africa right now, the states are showing that 61% of the COVID-19 patients in hospitals had hypertension, which is an NCD, and 52% had diabetes, again, which is an NCD. And tobacco use is linked to all these conditions, which again reiterates the need for us to really relook at the harm that tobacco is causing. And the WHO, in its business case for preventing non-communicable diseases as part of the Sustainable Development Goals, has actually again emphasized that one of the best buys, based on its cost effectiveness and also its effectiveness generally, is increasing excise taxes on tobacco products, amongst obviously other tobacco control policies. It has emphasized that, investing, in control of NCDs actually is very important for growth and for development. So that is really our submission. So again, here, you see that under the Sustainable Development Goals, one of the main things that has really been emphasized is the need to try and reduce the non-communicable disease burden. And reducing tobacco use is very important in that regard. And increasing taxes really is one of the most effective ways to actually do reduce tobacco use. And we cannot continue on this path with a sustainable health burden. So my conclusion really is that, lives will be saved when we increase tobacco taxes marginally above inflation, way above the inflation rates. Lives will be saved, and disease burden will really be greatly reduced. And when we do that, we'll save the harm from tobacco, when we also increase government revenue. So curbing the tobacco epidemic, my last point really is that we want to just reiterate and remember that curbing the epidemic is beneficial to every sector of the community. So be it, for example, employment, be it the economic side, be it, the health side, to every sector, it is beneficial for us to basically curb the epidemic. And also, it actually is also beneficial to each and every department of government, because currently controlling tobacco makes much economical sense. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Now we'll have Via Steelenos. Thank you.
Hi, Chair.
Yes, Nkululeko.
I've tried to send them even an email. I didn't see them on in the platform. I sent them an email. They never responded.
Fine. So, Pioneer Steel, Pioneer Metals, next. Are they here?
Even the next Pioneer Metals, I'll send them an email.
We've got written submissions from them. We'll deal with it that way. I'm sorry that you can't see me properly. It's just that my battery, unfortunately, has gone down on my iPad and the connection here is at a really strange place. I haven't used this long before. Okay, you can see it. It doesn't matter whether you can see me or not. I mean, really, does that matter? What matters is you hear me. So it's 12J Association. They're here, right? No, it's Barnes Group. Sorry, Barnes Group. Are you here, Barnes Group?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
Chair.
Yes.
Before Barnes Group, there is another
Sorry. I've been slightly sort of put off by this thing, almost this electric thing going dead. It's my fault. I should have checked the battery last night. Okay, Ed. How you say this? Ed Invest, whatever. Ed Invest, okay. Are you here?
Yes.
Go for it.
Good morning. Yeah. Good morning, Chair. My name is Marissa. I'm from a company called Ed Invest. And similar to Smart Funder, we are an administrator for the employer provided bursary. So if we, and I quickly had to change my presentation slightly because I didn't want to repeat the things that Francois Diepenberg from Smart Funder.
Yes, good.
Okay, yes. So if we look at what the comments were, the Treasury response to the Standing Committee on Finance on the 13th of October, they said reinstating the salary sacrifice requirement undermines, well, that was what the service providers and the stakeholders said, is that we said that if they take away the salary sacrifice, they're going to undermine government's objective to assist and uplift skills development. And then their response was not accepted. While government remains committed to the skills development objectives, government also needs to acknowledge when they've, when policy decisions previously taken are making tax abuse easier for taxpayers. And I'm going to skip the rest. You can read through it when you have time. And I want to give you a little bit of background if for those who did not know, when the draft explanatory memorandum came out this year, they said the following, they highlighted, they said that provisions in the current Act provide for exemption in respect of bona fide bursaries granted by employers to employees or relatives. It's still there and it was available for people to use since about 1992. In 2006, like Francois had highlighted, government included a salary sacrifice element. And they said that the policy rationale for the removal of the exclusion of the salary sacrifice was to specifically encourage skills development as a means of addressing the country's skills shortage. And I want to highlight that. Following the 2006 amendment of the inclusion of the salary sacrifice element, it actually became... Well, if you go back on the historic statistics, we'll look at that now. It became evident that even less people used the bursary and scholarship scheme after they introduced this, the salary sacrifice element. So I'm not gonna spend much time on this slide. This is what Francois said this morning. So what they said is bona fide bursaries granted to employees. They wanted to make it easier for people to use, and that's why they basically brought in the salary sacrifice. They also mentioned, I have to highlight this, that they said current law contains an anti-avoidance charge designed to dissuade employers from providing scholarships and bursaries as a form of salary sacrifice. Okay? And they said the salary sacrifice as a component of the exemption creates unnecessary difficulties in application. Whilst justifiable as a matter of legal theory, this distinction makes little economic sense in light of the skill shortage within South Africa. We need to remember what they said when they brought in the provision of the salary sacrifice in 2006. So if we skip the next one, Francois spoke about this. I'm not going to talk about that now. When government brought out the explanatory memorandum, they said the following. They said that they've seen that there's a number of schemes that have emerged in respect of the employer-provided bursaries. They said that these schemes are developed by institutions such as ourselves and Smart Funder to offer the bursary to employees. We do all the work on behalf of the employers who don't have the skills, who don't have the time, who don't have the resources to do it. We do this so that employees can partake in this salary sacrifice because they are paying for a relative's education. Okay? And then towards the end, they said the increase in the number of these schemes as well as the tax planning opportunities resulted in a loss to fiscus. I want to also just highlight that. So as you can see on the right-hand side, this is statistics that we found on SAS-SA for the taxpayers that have made use of the bursary scheme over the last few years. You can see it's very evident that employers were not utilizing this, maybe because it was just so difficult to actually know how to implement it. So there was no real encouragement towards government's efforts to address the skill shortage in the country. So service providers like ourselves and Smart Funder, we realized that this was not being utilized, and we came up with a model which would ensure that we comply with the current regulations and we are able to allow employees to utilize the bursary because they are paying for someone's education. Okay, cool. I'm not going to talk about the threshold. Francois spoke about that. Our service providers who do this, we are now actually encouraging the efforts of governments to address skill shortages, and we are helping the lower to middle class employees to be able to reduce their PIYE because they are contributing towards education in the country. And I'm going really quickly because I know we're under the time constraints. So Southern Treasury's comments to some of the public hearings were as follows. They said, in the introduction to the meetings, they said that they knew that there were service providers doing this service for employers and they did not mind. They said it made no difference whether it was an employer offering the service or doing it themselves or whether it was an institution who offered these services. Towards the end of the discussion, and if you ask some of the attendees, it was quite a long debate. I think we kept them busy for more than an hour. SARS actually then said they actually have a problem with the institutions and the service providers, and they've got concerns on how it was being implemented. So just make a mental note of that. So I'm also going to stress the fact that in the public hearing, the Honourable Chair had asked Treasury to investigate and report back on who is this actually benefiting. Like Francois said, we didn't get a response on that. Treasury also was asked to quantify the loss to the fiscus, and unfortunately we've got no feedback. So I also want to highlight the following two things underlined in red. Treasury stated that if a salary sacrifice is indeed used for a bursary or a scholarship, they then did not see this as a bona fide bursary, which is very weird because it's in total contrast to what they said in 2006 when they made the provision to include a salary sacrifice. Okay, so those, I did say that the Honourable Chair's requests were not answered, and if I'm correct, memory serves me right, Mr. Jordan Hill Lewis also raised some queries at the end of the discussion which I don't believe were addressed. So I want to just focus on a little bit of data in terms of education in South Africa. Almost 2 in every 10 potential learners in our country are unable to attend a school or a tertiary institution because they do not have the money. The estimated cost in 2019 to educate a child at school was about 130.50 rand a day. Think about the minimum wage in our country. Okay, let's go to 40% of South Africa's, this is very concerning, 40% of South Africa's 20 million young people between the ages of 15 and 34 are not employed. They're not in any sort of education or training, and this was according to Stats survey that was done a few years ago. Let's just go to the next slide. Tertiary attainment in South Africa is the lowest across all OECD countries in the world. Tertiary qualifications in South Africa are very not common. Only 7% of adults have...
Sorry, with due respect, I mean, you know, I think we know the broad case for yes. funding. The government's desperate, perhaps more desperate now than ever before, given the COVID crisis. So I don't think you should overdo this. Focus on other issues related to the specific clauses in the tax bills that you're dealing with, because we know much of this anyway. I don't think you need to convince us on that score, but we need support from the private sector, my friend. Yes. Okay.
Okay. Perfect.
Let's find a way out where National Treasury is and where you are. Offer compromises and so on which we can convince our colleagues in the NA, if we so choose, once we've considered the matters fully, that they need to reconsider these clauses. Okay, go ahead, please.
Okay.
You've got a very few minutes left. Actually, you've used I'm fine. I'll give you another 2 minutes at most because you're covering ground that, yeah.
Here we go.
Okay, 2 minutes then.
So in a nutshell, we agree with Smart Funder. Tell us what we need to do, how we need to regulate it, and we will do it. We can actually also just highlight the fact that for the bursaries to be more effective and to actually benefit the community, we suggest the public servant be made aware and be allowed to actually use this. Salaries in most industries will not be increasing in the near future. We can also reduce the heavy burden on NASFAS if we keep it in and not take it out. Just quickly, in 2019, there was wage negotiation standards between SOA where they had actually agreed that they will use this bursary to make up for the 2.1% annual increase, which SAA couldn't afford. I'm going to give you feedback of, let's look at two people that are using this. The education benefit is helping me a great deal. I can now cover my kids' school needs more than before. Patricia Makuna from Liquid Telecom said, there are no words good enough to thank you for changing my life. Last slide. If you look at the left-hand side, we are definitely helping the lower income people as well. Someone with 90,000 Rand earnings a year can potentially put back 1,200 Rand in their pocket if they spend at least 6,900 Rand on someone's education. If they get 99,000 and they spend 18,000 between two or three children, they can save 3,500 Rand, and you have no idea what and how far this can go towards helping the South Africans in the country. Thank you, Chair. That's all from me.
Okay, thank you very much. Then next comes the Barnes Group. Are you here? Barnes Group?
Yes, I am here. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I'm going to share my screen. Thank you. This is my presentation, and thanks for the opportunity to present. I'm talking about the export duty on scrap metals. And just as an opening statement, I'd like to say that, as I'm sure most of us feel, that South Africa should be a nation of champion manufacturers and not a nation of scrap collecting experts that export our raw material to other developing countries such as India, Pakistan and Vietnam, where they take our raw material and produce finished products. The steel makers in South Africa who utilize the scrap metal employ the total steel industry employs between 200,000 and 300,000 people in the upstream and downstream industry, and create a lot of good jobs that are paying substantially higher than the minimum wages. At Score Metals, our average wage rate that we are paying for our employee currently is around 90 Rand an hour, excluding benefits. Now, we do a lot for our employees. When you look at us and compare to a scrap collecting business who supply us, most of those businesses are paying the minimum rate to their employees for scrap at around working in that industry of around 22 to 25 Rand an hour. Now, we very much appreciate the export duty on scrap as the industry, but we request, and I did in the previous presentation, request that we put a minimum tax that should be paid of 1,000 Rand per ton, or 20% of the value of the scrap, whichever is higher. Now, it's important to understand that it's very difficult to grade scrap in any market in the world. And the scrap business is a very corrupt business, often dealing in stolen goods and significant cash payments in the industry. The value of scrap can range from 100%, which is if we look at an international pricing model for a particular grade of scrap, and for a lower grade of scrap, it could be as little as 50% of that value. If we don't put a minimum tax of 1,000 rand, what one would see is exporting the scrap exporters would export low, or be perceived to export low value scrap. Hello?
Very crackly. I can't hear you.
Sorry, is that better? Exporting, if we don't
Hello? Yeah, can you just repeat what you said? The last two
The scrap business is very corrupt. If we don't put a minimum value on the export, the tax, what the scrap dealers will do, they would be exporting, they would invoice out scrap at a very low price. It's almost subjective, the value of scrap. And it's almost impossible to value scrap in a court. So for SARS to value scrap and to argue against the scrap dealer at what the grade of that scrap is compared to what the value of that scrap is, it's impossible. One can argue the quantities of low-grade scrap in a particular shipment is much higher than what is actually in that shipment. You can't sort out scrap. It's very, very difficult. When one buys scrap, as Score Metals, we purchase up to 2,500 tons of scrap a day. We have permanent people taking photos, grading the scrap, and downgrading scrap, because obviously scrap supply scrap at the highest value possible. We then have to downgrade scrap. In order to downgrade that scrap and pay them less for the scrap, we take photos of each load as it comes in. We manage that. We send them the photos of the scrap. We argue with them in terms of the value of the scrap that we pay them for. Now, when exporting scrap, very easy to export scrap at a low value. And there is absolutely no ways, I don't believe it at all, that SARS has the capability, or in fact anyone has the capability, to take a particular shipment of scrap and say, no, this is valued at high grade scrap compared to low grade scrap, with a difference of up to 50% in the value of that scrap. So based on this ability to value scrap, we're not exporting here a bottle of Coca-Cola, which is 1 liter. It's not at all. What we hear is exporting a product that is almost impossible to grade. And allowing the scrap at 20% of the value will open up the door for under invoicing of good quality scrap going out as bad quality scrap, which opens the door for losses to the revenue in various forms for South Africa. And in fact, money laundering as well, because they take the money out of South Africa via exporting scrap at a low value, which they are currently doing today. My next point is the export of the export tax, which we're requesting to be 20% or 1,000 rand, must be levied on all exports, and including those that are going to the EU, EFTA, and SADC. And only once it is proven by the exporter that the scrap was actually used in those jurisdictions should a refund be paid to these scrap dealers. Scrap dealers, what they will do and what they've done in the past with the current systems, whatever opportunity there is to try and deviate from the system they utilize, they will be exporting to these countries and rerouting the scrap to countries where the duties will be paid. I've just put an example down here that exports scrap to Swaziland and then from Swaziland via Mozambique, packing containers and export without duties. So this needs to be managed. And in order to manage that, the burden of proof should be put on the exporter of the scrap. He needs to produce proof of export of where the scrap is being used And once that has been proven to the satisfactory of a responsible person at SARS, then the export tax that was paid must be refunded. That is critical for us in the steel industry. The next point that we have is exports must only be allowed via break bulk shipment and not via containers. Currently, exports in containers that have happened, very difficult. The containers are packed in a manner that one cannot open and inspect the containers. They also have been exporting infrastructure that has been stolen from South Africa. I was at the investment conference on Wednesday with Andre Dereka from Eskom, and he asked me the question, how do we stop their infrastructure being stolen? He mentioned, Andre Dereka himself said to me that a mine shaft stopped with 400 miners underground because they stole the pylons, the scrap of the angolans from the pylons. The pylon collapsed, that 400 miners stuck underground becomes an Eskom problem. Now, exporting in containers allows scrap dealers to put stolen infrastructure into the containers that cannot be visible. If we export via break bulk, at least it's an opportunity for all product to be visible while it's being exported. We also had cuts, we've also seen in the past stolen, I'm talking about ferrous, which is metal, but which is valued today at around 3,500 rand a ton, but non-ferrous, which is copper cables and aluminium cables, that kind of thing, is valued at about 20,000 rand a ton, and those copper cables are often put inside the containers and covered up with steel and then exported out as ferrous, as steel scrap, and the non-ferrous is going with them. This needs to be prevented. So exporting of scrap via break bulk will prevent, we believe, will prevent a lot of government and private infrastructure from being stolen. We currently have, my next point is, we currently have a PPS system in place, which there's an export price of scrap that has to be offered. So we're happy with the export tax being utilized to determine the price of scrap to be exported. However, we are requesting that the permit system stay in place. An important thing, so this is the permit system allows the steel mills to have an offer, to make an offer to purchase the scrap prior to it being exported. And this is very important to us. Scrap is not a product that is manufactured, it's generated. The amount of scrap that can be generated in a country is limited. It's not a function of what can be generated. Scrap is a function of the economic activity, and there's a finite amount. If we don't have a permit system in place, our scrap, which is our raw material, will be exported. And there's a limited supply, and supply and demand is often not balanced. And what we've seen in the past is that if there's an opportunity to export scrap, our scrap is exported, there's a shortage created in the local market, and which drives prices up significantly higher than the export price of scrap, actually. And this puts a lot of pressure on our steel mills and our manufacturing businesses. And the reason for this is that the steel mills, the cost of standing a steel mill without scrap is much, much bigger than the cost of holding the scrap away from the steel mill. So we actually add a bit of a disadvantage when there is exports, when there's an ability to export scrap. Thank you. Thank you very much for that opportunity. Any questions?
Yeah, we will come back to you. You were at 11:19, but I give you the space because, colleagues, this is quite a fascinating input. We need to hear what Treasury has to say. But thank you for that. Very interesting. Then we've got, am I right that VS Steel and Pioneer Metals are still not here in Kulalekwa? Am I right about that?
Yeah, still not here, Chair.
All right, well, we've got a bit more space for discussion then. Then we have 12J Association. Are they here?
Yes, we're here, Honourable Chair.
Go for it.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chair. By way of background, my name is Dino Zicolo. I'm the chairman of the 12J Association of South Africa, which is an independently constituted industry body that represents approximately 85% of the Section 12J industry in the country. And it's my pleasure this morning to present to you on what we believe to be a material omission from the T-Lab that National Treasury have put forward. I think maybe just to start, by way of a bit of background, many of the members of this committee will remember myself from a conversation that we had in person in Parliament last year, where we held a robust discussion regarding the merits of Section 12J and the incentive and the case for, at the time, was a discussion around the cap. Thank you. I think, Honourable Chair, one of the key elements that came away from that conversation last year is that you tasked the industry with going back and going out to our members and obtaining hard facts such that we could come back to you and present on the basis not just of hearsay, but of credible data that could inform a decision. And I think we're pleased to announce this morning or to present to you that during lockdown, we as the 12J Association of South Africa conducted an extensive survey of our members regarding the impacts of Section 12J in South Africa. We released this report in July of this year, and a copy of that report was sent to Nkululeko previously and ahead of this meeting for the consideration of the various committee members. I think by way of an agenda, just for the rest of my presentation this morning, what I'll do is very briefly provide a bit of background to 12J and the incentive, just to recap. I'll then delve deeper into two or three of the key elements of what came out of the report. And then I'll touch on the rationale for what we believe to be the omission in the T-Lab of this year. Maybe just to start, what is Section 12J? In simple terms, 12J came about in the Income Tax Act in 2009 with a stated intention of promoting private investments into SMMEs around the country and to create jobs. It was only in 2015, though, when SARS made some changes to the law alongside National Treasury, that 12J really gained traction. And when the law was originally brought about, and this speaks to the submission today, there was always what was called a sunset clause that provided that in June of 2021, Section 12J would cease to exist, pending any extension by National Treasury of the law. Since 2015, there's been significant uptake of the incentive. There's been in excess of 9 billion raised based on a survey of our members. And we're very pleased to report to the committee that of the 9 billion raised, more than 5 billion of it has been invested into SMMEs around the country. And if you exclude the 2 billion that was raised just before COVID broke out, and I'm sure everyone can appreciate that it's very difficult to make investments during COVID, that equates to about 75% of the total money which was raised having been spent around the country. Where are we today? We believe that 12J has begun to have a meaningful impact on the South African economy and to create jobs into a sector which is absolutely fundamental for the growth of our country. To quote some of National Treasury's statistics from their economic policy document, which they released last year, 50% of all of new job creation comes from the SMME sector, and the sector contributes 45% of GDP to South Africa. So it really is an important sector of the economy, and I would argue probably one that has been the most hard hit as a consequence of COVID-19. To touch on some of the key findings of the report, Honourable Chair, that we went out and commissioned, the first is that Section 12J has been an incredibly effective mechanism to raise incremental investor capital for five-year lock-up investments in South Africa at a time where a lot of high net worth individuals are taking their money offshore. We put the question to our members and to our investors, would you have invested in a five-year SMME investment had it not been for 12J? 82% of them said no. And for us, this was crucial because it makes the point that 12J is driving behavior and that it's actually changing the way that South African investors behave. In addition, we found, based on, the survey of our members, that the industry has made 360 investments into SMMEs around the country at an average of 15 million rand per SMME. And that's into sectors including agriculture, renewable energy, schools, student accommodation. And I think a key one is hotels and tourism, which obviously has been one of the most affected industries as a consequence of COVID. We also asked our members how many jobs have been created in the underlying investee businesses. And the answer was 10,500 jobs have been created, 75% of them from previously disadvantaged individuals. at an average cost per job of 126,000 Rand, which we think is incredibly compelling given the circumstances. I think a key point, you know, and it's been touched on a few times in this morning's session, is the concept of, you know, the fiscus and the need for tax revenues and the cost of incentives at this point in time. I think one thing for us that's fundamental about 12J is that the underlying investee businesses pay VAT, they pay corporate tax, they pay CGT, dividends tax, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we included in the report was a model that effectively showed that given enough time, Section 12J should actually become a self-funding mechanism. In other words, that quantum of the taxes paid in the underlying investee businesses should in any given year exceed potentially the amount of deductions given in that same year, as it is in the case in the UK at the moment. And we proved that statistically in our report. With all of that being said, you know, what is the purpose of our presentation to you today other than to deliver on our promise of giving the committee more information? And that is this concept of the sunset clause, which, as I mentioned, currently takes effect on 30 June 2021, and which says that no new Section 12J deduction will be granted over or beyond that date. Our concern, Honourable Chair, is that there has been no reference to what will take place as regards an extension in the TLAB of this year. Now, I will admit and concede that National Treasury has put in place a process. They are having a session on the 2nd of December with the industry to discuss the results of their own report, which they commissioned. And I would assume to begin the conversation around an extension. Our concern, however, is that, as we can see with the TLAB process of this year, we're in, you know, nearly December and the new bills haven't been promulgated and finalized. And the concern we have is that it is highly likely that without the extension of the legislation being contemplated in this legislative cycle, that the sunset clause in law will come into effect before any changes are made, should any changes be made. I think, in summary, you know, we believe that the president and the government's operation Vulindlela is something that is absolutely necessary in South Africa. The concept of growth supportive structural reforms is one that our country needs more than ever, and we believe that 12J is an ideal existing structure to continue with this. The benefits, as I've mentioned, include the concept of reversing capital flights out of our country, encouraging investments into strategic sectors of the economy, and Treasury and Parliament have the ability to direct which sectors of the economy they want 12J investments to go into. The incentive also increases tax revenues and helps small businesses access capital at a time when, again, you know, our view, SMMEs need capital more than ever. That being said, we believe that if 12J isn't extended, and not just extended, but if it isn't extended timeously, there are various potential adverse consequences to the country for that action and that course of action. That includes billions of potential rands in offshore investments or money going out of South Africa as a consequence, the loss of jobs and the loss of a focus on SMMEs, which, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the cornerstones of job creation and tax generation in our country. I think another practical point is that there is an industry that has been, you know, that has been tasked with administering 12J investments. And these businesses, to quote the president and to quote various members of our government time and time again, that industry and any industry needs policy certainty in order to be able to operate. Where we sit at the moment is we're staring in the face of a sunset clause where we have absolutely no intention or understanding from Treasury or government what the intention is regarding the future of what is one of the most important incentives of our country, especially in COVID. And that puts a commercial risk on all managers of businesses in Section 12J around the country, because it's almost impossible for the managers of our members' businesses to justify further capex into their businesses, the hiring of additional staff. And not only at the business level is it a risk, it's also a risk to our investors who are looking for policy certainty in order to be able to be convinced to invest five-year lockup money in South Africa going forward. And so I suppose in conclusion, it's important to highlight that Section 12J is not our success. It is National Treasury and government's success. You know, this was brought in by yourselves as a test. Now, that test was supposed to be of 12 years. It only gained traction in 2015, where there were changes made to the law. And so in consequence, it's only actually been around for 6 years. We are strongly of the view that there is merit for a five-year extension of Section 12J. And we would like to start that discussion with National Treasury, with SARS, and of course with you as government now, in order to ensure that this conversation is had earlier rather than later. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That's done with all the inputs, comments, questions, contributions, please. Is anybody else in Kulileko left out? No?
Yes, Chair. I should get a message now. Yes, still is online.
Yeah, but I mean, really, now they're disrupting our program. I mean, surely they could have let you know that they're not going to be here because I gave more latitude to some of the speakers now thinking they're not going to be here, but fine. Okay, go for it. 10 minutes strictly. I'm starting to monitor you. Are you here?
Yes, sir. Hi, this is Sachin. Right.
How are you? Yeah, you're late, but go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I represent a company called Vsteel Mills, which is a purely scrap beneficiation company in...
Excuse me, can you put your video on, please? Because Parliament IT people require the speaker. Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Sachin representing Vsteel Mills. We are a secondary steel producer in Johannesburg. Having said that, in fact, our submission, I'm going to just... going to share my screen. Just one sec. So just give me one second. I'm trying to get this right. Just one. I'm not going to get, I'm not able to get this right, but anyway, let me continue with our submission. We are actually one of the product of the policies of DTI and ITAC. We are one of the company which has completely transformed from 100% scrap exporter to 100% scrap consumer. We started our journey, yeah, thank you. We started our journey in 2013 where we started transforming ourselves from a scrap exporter to scrap consumer locally. We are actually proudly employ around 1,200 full-time jobs in Johannesburg, and we are completely in support of this proposal. However, there are certain things which I would like to highlight. One is, if you look at the point number two, I'm going to run through quickly, that minimum threshold taxation must apply to all scrap metal category in order to combat practice of false invoicing. Normally what will happen is people will start doing invoicing at a lower value to avoid the taxation amount. Percentages of rates of taxes of export duty is lower then desired. Like for example, if you look at the waste and scrap of steel, cast iron and everything, it should be 30%, 20% will not be enough. We are, if you look at the prices and the competitiveness which is needed to be provided to the local industry, we need to have minimum of 30% of export tax on iron, 20% on stainless steel. If you look at the yellow part of that, that will actually give you an idea what we are favoring in the tax rate. Most importantly, this step of government will increase the industrialization in South Africa, will bring the existing player and bring more industries in South Africa, and it will enhance their competitiveness in the short term. In the long run, as the time progresses, they will achieve the international level competitiveness through the whole process. In fact, we also, as presently do non-ferrous also, we just recently bought Hulamin's asset in Olifantsfontein. So we're the only company who will be in all three verticals, steel, aluminium, as well as copper alloys. We have taken this step looking at into this the taxes, export taxes being proposed. Similarly, like us, there will be a lot of other players and new industries. As a matter of fact, there's already a lot of people thinking of setting up industries in South Africa because of this step. And I must say that this is the step in the right direction. Just address the look into the tax rates, and it will have all the desired effect. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Are we done, Nkululeko? Can you please stay? We're going to put questions to you and the rest who spoke in the slot. Nkululeko, I take it there's nobody else now, right?
Yes, Chair. Yes, Chair.
Okay. Over then to members. Sorry. Yes. Okay, fine. Then let's have questions, comments, please. Whose hand is up? I see Moletsane, Willy, Dennis. Yep. Right, and so it is. Go ahead, please. Go ahead in that order, please.
Thank you, Chair. My question goes to Section 12J. They've mentioned that they have invested into different provinces. I just want to check whether they have done that in all provinces. If not, which provinces so far they have invested in them, under agriculture? And secondly, does it also include all the small developing farmers across the colour? Thank you, Chair.
Next.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's Willy. Chairperson, my first question is to the presenter of the National Council Against Smoking. You mentioned an amount of, if I'm not mistaken, I think 41 billion rand of medical expenses that annually include due to smoking. And you also said that the excise tax only brings in 13 billion rands. My question is, though, that sure, the 13 billion rands that you spoke about is excise tax, but have you considered the other income that is also brought in by this industry? And there I'm talking about VAT that is paid by these companies. I'm not only talking about the excise tax, I'm talking about VAT. I'm talking about the employees tax that are paid by the tobacco industry, which also is an income to government. I'm also talking about income tax that those companies are paying. I think it is, I don't want to use the word disingenuous, but I think it is only concentrating on excise tax instead of looking at the total contribution to tax that those companies are making. You cannot only compare excise tax on and compare that with medical expenses. You've got to look at the bigger picture of the total income that is brought about there. That is just my question. And if you did that, can you give us those figures, what the total tax contribution of the tobacco industry is, not only the excise portion thereof?
Yeah, you know what, you'll have to reply for about 5 minutes.
Sure. Then the other question... Sorry, Chairperson? Can I carry on?
Yes, no, I'm doing work related to this. It's not about private. I spoke to Yanga that instead of replying tomorrow, she must reply
Sorry,
now.
Sorry, Chairperson?
Yeah, I'm doing my job.
Chairperson, yeah. I think you are talking to somebody else. Maybe you should just mute.
No. I realize I should mute, but I'm telling you, it's a human error. I don't apologize in the sense that it's human. But what I'm telling you is I'm not ringing my wife or my family. I'm ringing Yanga to tell her that given the quality of the inputs and the quality of the questions, that doesn't include you, I mean the other questions, I would like her to reply now, at least in 5 minutes, so that those who can't attend tomorrow, Willie, right, they can at least hear some sort of response. Now, what other chairperson would do that in this parliament? Have you ever heard of that? So I'm doing my job. I'm not ringing my family or my ANC comrades. I'm doing my job. Sorry about muting. It's a big crime. Go to the speaker. Go to the United Nations and say, I accidentally left the mute on. Okay? Go ahead. Take the official report. Yeah. Thank you.
You are such a classic. I think you're the one person that is allowed to do that. So we actually welcome that. Thank you so much. Chairperson, just the other comments that I want to make. Prof. Cornet from REAP also has a few comments, and there was a comment in the chat box as well. The point that I want to make is to come and to say that lockdown showed us that people are willing to pay more for tobacco products. Therefore, we must tax them more. That is not going to be taxation. That is going to be exploitation. Just it's actually going to be a, you can call it a silly tax, to say that people are silly enough to be willing to pay more for tobacco. Therefore, we must tax them more. It's not working like that. I agree that a gradual increase must take place, but to all of a sudden say people paid 20 rands per packet, which they for now paid 110 rands per packet, now all of a sudden they are willing to pay more, so we must tax them more. I don't think it should work like that. I do think, and I do agree with you, that more measures must be put in place in order to curb the growth in tobacco users. The other question or the other point that I just want to make, Chair, is that in that comment, it was said that the tobacco industry exploited people. It was not the tobacco industry that exploited people during the lockdown. It was the illegal tobacco industry that exploited people. And there we must have a big look at the whole situation. 2 weeks ago, during our committee meeting, we spoke about having a base price for a packet of cigarettes. Maybe that is what we should do. If you look at cigarettes being taxed...
Just repeat what you just said, because we lost about 30 seconds of what you said.
Okay, I'll repeat that.
Please, yeah.
Because what I said is that during lockdown, Chair, it was said in that comment that the tobacco industry exploited the tobacco users. That is not the case. It was not the tobacco industry. It was the illegal tobacco industry that exploited people. We must get to a point, and we discussed that in our previous meeting when we discussed this topic, where we set a base price for a packet of cigarettes. It cannot be that the tax on, or the excise tax on a packet of cigarettes is around about 17 rands, and a packet is then sold for 20 rands. There are no profit in that. I think if a base price for a packet of cigarettes are set, it will benefit the whole economy due to the fact that it will cut the throat of the illicit tobacco industry, which I think is very important. Those are cigarettes that are not adhering to health standards, and we must get that out of the system. But yeah, those are the points that I wanted to make. I would like some comments and feedback on that. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you.
And you can't leave your mic on.
Dennis, your turn. Let me switch off my mic immediately before I get...
No, Chairperson, you just muted yourself when you shouldn't. I think you said it was my turn, so I'll go for it. Thank you very much. Good. I'd like to start. Yes, National Council Against Smoking. Your position, as far as I could tell, was we need to tax cigarettes to a point that stops people from smoking or reduces smoking. And effectively, you're trying to use tax as a mechanism to enforce
behavior.
Are
we losing you, Dennis?
So, look, I think that the question is
right now.
You?
Sorry, Chair, we can hear him. I think there might be a bandwidth problem on your side.
Great. So I think that the issue is that trying to enforce behavior through taxation, certainly if the motivation
behind it is... Maybe it's on my side, but I get the drift. Okay.
So if there's a health reason for wanting to enforce a type of behavior, taxation can only be one part of your strategy. The other part of the strategy needs to be a campaign of education and a campaign from the health department side. Now, do you remember that big advertising campaign that the health department has been on recently? No, because there isn't one. What they've done is they've taken the easy route out, merely saying, well, let's syntax these things and not taking their responsibility. You can't expect that to work, and I don't believe that the Treasury or SARS can be the bulldogs of the health department. I think that there needs to be a bigger approach. And so I don't believe that pursuing the taxation side of things doggedly is something that we can easily agree to. I think that there needs to be some willingness shown from the other department, which is actually the owner department of the issue. That was my first point. The next presentation, Edinvest. I think Ms. du Plessis, you continued where Smart Funder worked off. And I think that you emphasized some of their points. You added quite a lot to their argument, and I appreciate that. And I'm more convinced than ever that this change or this removal of an incentive is absolutely the wrong thing to do, and that we need to oppose that as a committee. I want to tackle on slide six, Ms. du Plessis, you raised the issue. You said you've approached SARS on various occasions to discuss certain things, and they were reluctant to engage. I want to hear more from SARS and Treasury on that, because this was the same situation we faced with Section 12J last year, and I don't think it's right. Treasury and SARS must be engaging with key stakeholders, must be making sure that they get good inputs, and must remember that they have a role to play as public servants. And in terms of openness and transparency, I certainly believe there should be more engagement than less. And then certainly when you went on, I think it was two slides later, you highlighted certain questions that were asked at the recent standing committee meeting where you did not receive responses or didn't receive adequate responses. This is not right. Treasury, you guys are on the thick pile of carpet on this one. You know, the thicker the pile of the carpet, the deeper the trouble that you're in. So I think you really need to answer to that. Mr. Barnes raised some complex and industry-specific circumstances, and I'm not going to even pretend to understand even half of it. I do think that he raised some serious alarm bells, and certainly in terms of the basics of economics, when you find that your local price substantially exceeds your export price, you've got a serious problem with your market. And there's something wrong. If there's price disparity like that between local and export, considering the hoops one has to jump through in order to get an export shipment on the water, there's something fishy going on. And I think that you've raised some serious flags. I would like to hear some responses from Treasury on that. In terms of Section 12J, well, I think your presentation spoke for itself. And obviously we'd like to hear Treasury reply to you. Mr. Session, yes, I think you have a tough case to make, but let's hear what Treasury's got to respond on that one. But I do think that the concerns raised by Mr. Barnes about the scrap metal industry were quite serious and need to be investigated quite thoroughly. I don't think it's something that our committee can do, but certainly the financial implications of it were made. Thank you.
I lost you now and then, but I gather it's just me on my side. We've had severe storms here in St. Lucie, so maybe that's affected our signal systems and so on. Well, let's have Zolani now, and then we've got to move towards responses from the stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Let me thank all the presenters for very interesting presentations. Well, let me start off by the presentation made by Sharon. Sharon, I want to understand their organization, whether it is putting pressure against the companies who are producing cigarettes, or they are putting pressure against the smokers themselves. I sort of got confused there as to where is their campaign placed, basically. Is it putting pressure on cigarettes and tobacco producers, or putting pressure on the actual consumers of tobacco products? I want to understand, and that question is linked to the issue of who is really getting exploited when taxation is actually increased? Is it the tobacco companies
or is it the end user, which is the consumers of the tobacco products? And then coming to Mr. Doron Barnes, he is making a lot of, Mr. Barnes, you're making a lot of allegations, and I'm not sure whether they are backed up by scientific evidence and proof for you to show. Or for instance, you are saying that the scrap metal business pricing in it is pretty much manipulated, and the business itself, the sector, is a very, very corrupt sector. The other allegation which we are making is that SARS and other related bodies do not have the capacity to be able to grade the actual scrap that goes out of the country. In fact, you go on to say that good quality scrap is exported, and you are saying it is exported as though it is bad scrap, and you are also saying that is underpinned by money laundering in the very same sector of scrap. But you stop short of telling us what sort of proposals you have in place to actually ensure that there is a change and a turnaround in that regard. What do you have as a measure which can see us turning the corner insofar as the allegations that you are making, that you are pointing us at? You're saying that there's no proof of export, the export tax that is paid is not exhibited, and all of those things ought to happen. And I pretty much think that you have a very strong point, but you are not coming out with solutions. You are only pointing out at problems. And perhaps it would be helpful if you would come up with proposals, because pointing out at problems without coming with solutions, you are also not helping us. Perhaps if you can shed some light in terms of what proposals do you have in place to ensure that we can turn around the situation, given all the list of allegations that you are making. And if you can also give us evidence to the effect of some of the things that you are mentioning. Now, coming to Dino, you know, Chairperson, the concept of sunset clauses is something that I really do not like. I don't think it's something that is progressive. Perhaps we need to look at sunrise clause instead of sunset, because we are pretty much still in a mess because of the sunset clauses and the compromises that we took during the time of the negotiation. So I think what we really need now as a country to turn our economy around is a sunrise rather than a sunset. So, Chair, having said that, Dino, I want to check the composition of J12 Association. Last year, I asked a question about the investments which are concentrated in mega cities and urban areas. And I see now that you are mentioning that you have tried your level best to spread your investments across the country. And I would like to zoom in right there, because you remember that I had made a point that some of these investments must actually go deep into the rural communities of our country, rural towns, because there's a lot of activity there, but there's also a lot of requirement, business requirement, for investment. And if you don't go to those areas will never see growth, because investment stimulates growth, and growth stimulates jobs, and jobs stimulate a healthy economy. So it's very key for me that you go into those areas in a pinpointed fashion. And it would be very good to check the composition of your own association, because sometimes you lose sight of certain areas simply because you find that you are a boys club who happen to come from the same community. It is very important in the South African context that we appreciate and always motivate for people to ensure that their composition is diverse and it is representative of the entire South African community, so that when you sit around the table, you can sort of have an objective sense of how you look at things. And the other thing, you are saying that if certain things are not done in accordance with your proposals, you will see a lot of people investing and taking money out of South Africa to go and invest abroad. And I want to ask a question. I think one of the reasons which I think are actually making certain people to strike against the economy of the same country where they make money from and take the money outside the country and go and spend it elsewhere, it's this issue of dual citizenship. I think it also plays a role in the sense that it makes people not to be loyal and pay 100% allegiance to South Africa. And people have confidence elsewhere to go and put their monies as if the monies are safer elsewhere. So to me, that is a strike against their own economy. So don't you think that we ought to look at that and come up with a critical policy proposal to actually ensure that we prevent that strike of people striking against the very same economy, because it begins to kill investment, confidence in the country, and by association, there will be no growth in our economy, and as such, it will create a scenario of joblessness. So, Chair, I think those are my three interventions, and I hope that I have covered, unless you will give us another chance for another bite. For now, that's what I want to put across. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Okay, Zolani, I've got another clash at 12 o'clock. You can take over chairing if you want, but I'll try to stay till about 10 past, because I think the issues are too important to just close a bit earlier at 12. So if people can, look, I'll stay till 12:10, but if the meeting wants to continue, Zolani, can you chair, please? Look, firstly, I want to make some general comments, okay? And I have to say, firstly, Yanga, I found you to say, you know, although you're giving a fuller, more comprehensive, more thought-out response, having considered what people said, and those who are not here and have written to us, and it's unfair to expect you to be ready. You see, the other option we can talk about, colleagues, is whether we give National Treasury more time. Yanga, can you reply to that? I really don't think we can rush this thing. Yanga, I must tell you, I'm surprised at the quality of inputs that have come from the stakeholders. The questions from the members have been very good. And I really don't think we can be, I don't know what happened on the other side, Yanga, but for example, Edinvest raised the question that on the NA side, they asked you, what about the loss to the fiscus? They repeat what was said earlier by Frank or Liebenberg. Nothing came of that. And who benefits, asked the chair of the committee on that side. You didn't reply. So firstly, I don't know why you wouldn't reply. Secondly, I don't know how the committee would decide on this matter without getting a reply, but maybe you spoke to them offline, the chair, whatever. So, you know, I'm a bit worried about where we are. So in the first instance, let's hear from you, Yanga, in a quick reply now, bearing in mind that you give a fuller reply later. Now, given the number of submissions you have to go through, which until, I don't know why, in Kulileko, why suddenly people flooded us on a Monday morning with requests? I don't know why people don't contact us earlier. They knew full well that they have issues, but now that we are where we are, so he's mourning about that, but it does disrupt us. So I would like Yanga to come back on this. Do you think you'll be ready by tomorrow? Or should we postpone it to Thursday, bearing in mind that the appropriations is also meeting, but I really don't want a rushed process, please, because then we're going to send you back. You might have to have meetings with some of the stakeholders on Friday and all that. So I think Thursday might be an option after caucus that we meet. I'll negotiate with House Chair Jomo Nyambi if it comes to that. And I will also obviously speak to the Chief Whip of the NCOP. So members, just think about it. Yanga will come back, whether she can be ready tomorrow. Secondly, I do think that the stakeholders who can should connect with us. It's easier with virtual meetings whenever we meet. At this stage, it's 11 to 2 tomorrow, but we can move it to Thursday. Probably, you know, we'll discuss with the opposition parties. I think caucus finishes around 12:30, poll parties, 12:30 to whatever time, without intruding on the time of the Appropriations Committee. Now, the Barnes Group, I must say, I found this the most fascinating input, right? I want to ask you, Yanga. So you guys are not experts, right, on tax, I mean, on scrap metal, how to evaluate the quality of high grade and low grade and all of that. You're expert on taxes. Do you actually consult with independent experts You can hear the Barnes Group and whoever, but you know, you have to consult with independent technical experts on scrap to advise you, you know, on what is legitimate and what the stakeholders, who are often self-interested, and that's normal in a democracy. I mean, people pursue their interests through engagement with parliament and secure whatever they can in terms of policies and laws. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, one needs some independent expertise. Sometimes, you know, younger, I don't know if you ever saw CSI, but there's this guy there, lead guy, brilliant guy, Grissom. He knew anything about everything about anywhere and anytime and any, it was impossible. He was better than the encyclopedia. And it lacked credibility. Sometimes I get the feeling, Treasury, you, like probably Treasury is all over the world, nothing wrong. You've just been very professional, consistent with your role in a, you know, tax policy making department. But sometimes I feel that you seem to, like, you know everything about, oh, let me go on, you're like Grissom of tax and treasury together with SARS. Now, I'm not saying that the people who are making submissions are right in their arguments. Well, they're right for their arguments, but whether we can agree with them. Everybody comes here to avoid paying taxes, obviously. Most of them presented as socially necessary their case and that they're serving the country's transformation goals. We know all of that. But some of them are genuine. Like the one on education really troubles me, as it does, I think, most, if not all of us. So on the matter of 12J, I hear you. I did a lot of work last year, by the way, around this time. I think I did most reading on your submissions last time. And I need to look at my notes. But a question to you would be, now, you know, at one level, what you're basically telling us is that, you know, you want the sunset clause, as it's called, or in the case of Zolani, the sunrise clause. So the sunset clause to be delayed by a year from the end of June next year to the June following year until these matters are resolved because of the reasons you set out, which is that if we don't do it now, then it's going to come into effect because there won't be a TLAB bill adopted before June next year. Zolani will argue, well, you're asking us to postpone the sunrise clause by a year. Well, however you see it, it's a postponement that's called for. But underlying what you say is this concern that if we go ahead with it, it'll undermine investment, growth, jobs, it'll reduce capital flight if we do what you say. Now, why would Treasury be so obsessed with these issues? And ultimately, never mind other departments, will have to bear the consequences and answer to the president for, you know, these things, the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition and this department. So why would they undermine government's goal? On VSP modes, I think I would like to hear Treasury's reply to that before I come to any independent view on the matter. So that said, whoever wants to comment, I think we're narrow on time, but you will have another opportunity if you so choose. So we'll extend it to 12:10, 10 minutes more. So it's 11:52 now. I suggest a 2-minute reply from each of you will do, because remember, we're taking no decisions here. We will only consider what our views are after having heard Treasury. So let's start in the order that you spoke, the Council Against Smoking.
Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead,
and thank you, Chair. And can thank you for me? All the comments.
Please.
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me? Okay. My first response is really to the issue of exploitation by Mr. Zolani, and our response to that is that we as a National Council Against Smoking, we are supporting people who use tobacco products, but the reality is most of them start before they reach adulthood. The reality is that most of them are actually addicted to to the use of tobacco products. So by actually pushing, for example, for the increase in taxation, we're actually helping people who use tobacco to actually make healthier choices. As for the tobacco industry, the reality is the tobacco industry is only concerned with making profits, and their interests are completely irreconcilable with public health. So you will see often that they will always oppose, like, you know, measures like increasing tax or even other tobacco control policies. And the issue of whether the NDOH is also doing their part, we are also using this platform specifically to talk about issues of tax. But we also definitely raised other issues like, you know, better tobacco control policies, which there is a bill which is currently underway as well. But there needs to be an all of government approach, because the issue of tobacco is not for the public health department only. The issue of tobacco should be a concern for each and every sector of government. And lastly, to the issue of the real cost of tobacco, the estimates that we give don't include the employees, tax, and you know the VAT, but they are basically an estimate and a picture which has been shown all over the world that controlling tobacco makes economic sense, and then there's no economic benefit to actually promoting tobacco use or to promoting the tobacco industry, you know, per se. So the other issue is that the real cost that we have, for example, the $42 billion estimate is not even depicting the real cost that tobacco causes to the economy. We don't know about the environmental costs, for example, that are, you know, are actually as a result of the tobacco industry. So our argument still remains that there is no, you know, economic benefit to promoting tobacco, whether, you know, it does kill a lot of people in South Africa. 115 people die each and every day from the tobacco, you know, related diseases, and also even from exposure to secondhand smoke. And lastly, you know, the issue of illicit trade versus the issue of illegal cigarettes. So illicit trade are those that don't pay tax. And what has been shown over and over in South Africa and even abroad is that most of these products are still coming from the legal tobacco industry itself. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. You're slightly over 2 minutes, but you're so passionate that I thought I couldn't dare stop you. So thank you for that. So a bit of passion helps the stakeholder. But it's very good argument from your side. I've heard it. I'm very familiar with your arguments of your organization. And I think you do great work. So keep it up. Steel Mills is not, well, let's take them in the order that they actually work here. So let's take the next one was Ed Invest, right? Ed and Invest. Okay, whatever it is, my friend, do you want to speak now?
Thank you, Tree. I think we have made our concerns and our points in our presentation, and I don't wish to add anything at this stage. Thank you so much.
My heart, because, you know, we are most empathetic to you and Mr. Liebenberg. So I think it's like flogging what a dead horse. Is that the expression where you're overdoing it? I think you've covered very well. Next is the Barnes Group.
I really enjoyed your
input, Barnes Group. I learned a lot from you. No, also yours, my dear. I'm talking about Barnes Group because it's totally new. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chair.
You're there, right?
Yes, can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. So thank you, Mr. Rod and Mr. McKeeva, for your comments. I'll just combine them together. A solution that you're looking for in terms of exporting scrap, our request to the steel industry would be to ban the exports of scrap completely. One cannot argue that our infrastructure, both private and public infrastructure, is being stolen. We often have power failures, electrical cables stolen, electrical pylons stolen. We have Transnet trains delivering iron ore from the Northern Cape. In some cases, the cables are stolen on that train line from the Northern Cape to here 4 or 5 times the train is stopped because of that. Transnet, Eskom, Telkom can all, I don't think I need to prove that. This is the industry that we deal with. Scrap is sold for cash to bucket shops on the side of the road. We don't believe that a full export ban on scrap is possible, but if you ask me for my solution, a full export ban on scrap is what is required. And that's what's happened. Mr. Minister Patel has implemented that from October until now, from September until now. And local scrap prices have gone up, the industry is flourishing, and all is good. If we can't get a total export ban on scrap, what we put and what I'm arguing for is a minimum rate of R1,000 per ton for scrap exported, ferrous scrap. That's the industry, that's steel scrap that we talk about, ferrous scrap. When you talk about grading scrap, Scrap is graded, it's very difficult. You can ask the CSIR, there's international grading books on scrap. The international grade of scrap is the 80-20, HMS 80-20, with 80% being a thick steel, 20% being a thin steel of a total parcel shipment. Now, in order to break that shipment out, you have to measure it, you have to separate the scrap in that particular shipment. Very, very difficult. To grade scrap is almost impossible, I say. And when I say that it's an opportunity for money laundering, and it's happening currently right now, people are exporting scrap at low values that's valued at a high rate to get money out of the country. You don't pay tax on it. You're not going to be paying the export tax on it. So to export scrap at the moment, when there's an export tax, it's going to force the exporter to reduce the value of the scrap being exported and pay the least amount of tax, and therefore enable that exporter to get money overseas. And remember, we're dealing with an industry that is very difficult to manage. It's based on steel scrap and other types of scrap. It's very difficult to manage. Our solution, and we try and assist SARS in grading imported steel, finished products that are specified, that have actual specifications for each item, and it's very difficult to actually achieve the grading of the steel coming in with SARS, and to make sure that there is no corruption, not from a SARS, corruption on the imported people grading or declaring the wrong tariff and paying a cheaper duty. Exporting okay. Scrap. Thank you.
And just tie up, please. Tie up. I'll finish.
Just exporting scrap without a minimum duty to be paid is going to be impossible to manage. Thank you.
Okay. Just very quickly, you've been engaging with Treasury about this before they brought the bill, right?
We have. Yes.
And you engaged with DTIC as well?
Yes, we have. We have.
Okay.
We've
all
engaged
right.
with them.
Fine.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay. I'll check on what's happening. Okay, next, please.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Chair, I'll 12J? Be the 12J Association next.
Where are you, 12J? Are you still here?
We are here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, please go for it. Yeah, go. Yeah.
Sure. Chair, thank you for the time again. I think these are complex issues that do require a longer conversation, but I'll do my best to summarize my responses in the 2 minutes. Honorable Moletsane, thank you very much for your points. I think to respond to some of your questions, are 12J investments in all provinces? Absolutely they are. And are there beneficiaries and investees that are of color? Absolutely. Per the report findings, obviously, naturally, more of the investment is in the major metro areas because that's where the majority of the economic activity is. We found that about 75% of investments are in the major metros, 25% are in outlying areas. As regards your question specifically in the agri sector, I think the report that we've shared with you is very useful, especially in Annexure A, where we've included various testimonials of some of the investments that have been invested into. Just to share some with you, for example, there's a table grape and citrus pack house in the Northern Cape that has been invested into and created 250 jobs through 12J. There's a macadamia nut farm in Mpumalanga that not only has it unlocked community-owned land, but it also employs 22 permanent workers from the local community. And I think this goes, Honorable Mkiva, to your question as well around, you know, who is benefiting from Section 12J. You know, we found that of the jobs created, 75% come from previously disadvantaged individuals. You know, to give you more examples of some of the investments, there's a lodge in the Kruger, Mdluli Safari Lodge, which is again on community-owned land that was unlocked through 12J. There's a business, Cape Mohair, that is a sock manufacturer in Cape Town that was in liquidation that 12J investments have invested into and saved it from having gone under. And the list goes on. I would refer you again to that annexure to our report. On the question of capital flight, I mean, it's a very nuanced question. And you know, the question I suppose that was asked is, how does one prevent capital flight? And there are a number of manners. The first, obviously, is through exchange control, which admittedly has been relaxed year on year for a long period of time now. The second, I would argue, is to create attractive local investments that promote investors to keep their capital in South Africa. I don't think that necessarily being a dual citizen would incentivize a person to take more money offshore. What we've seen from a lot of clients is that there's an attraction to take money offshore because it's perceived to be less risky. And I think one of the benefits that Section 12J has because of the tax incentive is that it does, to a degree, enhance returns for our clients, which is, in our view, one of the few mechanisms to keep capital onshore in South Africa at the moment. I think just the last point I'll make in the time allotted to me is that National Treasury's complaint and gripe around 12J for many years has been the concept of abuse. And over a number of changes in 2018, again last year, this abuse, in the view of the industry, has been clamped down on. Not only have there been, you know, a slew of amendments made to the law that, and I think Treasury will admit, has removed the potential for abuse, but also a cap has been placed on the legislation such that those very, very large investors are no longer able to be there. So what one has in 12J now is an ecosystem where you're getting small investments from small investments investors that are investing in small businesses, which I think was exactly the ecosystem that Treasury had in mind. And so I think collectively and collaboratively, we've got to a place where this thing can become a more sustainable part of the South African investment ecosystem. Thank you. And to the extent that there's any more questions, I'll happily submit a written submission after this.
Yes, but you could also respond a bit further if you care to, based on what people have said. Now we've got VS Steel. So are you there?
Yes, sir.
Right, you've got 2 minutes, my friend.
So there were some questions. I saw there's some questions wanted to be asked from me.
Well, basically, both Dennis Ryder and myself, we felt that we would like to hear Treasury's response before we make a conclusion on your comments. But given the general questions raised to others, is there anything you want to add? You've got 2 more minutes to supplement your submission, though you didn't use your full 10 minutes, obviously.
Okay. I can only add one thing is, my final submission in this would be, this is the right step in the direction of industrialization in South Africa, especially in the metal sector. It will help the downstream industry also, but we should be very careful in terms of what exactly we want to achieve. My final submission should be the tax, export tax should be either minimum like 1,000 rand on steel or 30%, whichever is the lowest. So this one will help to get more and more industries, and it will eventually help the downstream industries in South Africa. They'll be more competitive and we'll be able to create more value-added products in the economy. That's the only submission I would like to do. Or if this doesn't work, there should be a complete ban on export of scrap, which I think would be quite harsh, but eventually if that doesn't work, then that should be the last step. That's all. That's my final submission.
Right. Thank you, sir. Now, Yanga, frankly, do you think you will be, you can spend 2 minutes of your time quickly giving an overview of your reply in anticipation of a fuller reply. Secondly, do you think you'll be ready fully by tomorrow to actually do your reply? Thirdly, do you want to meet with some of the stakeholders, especially the smart funder, Edge Invest Group, and actually engage with them and see whether, you can sort of come to some sort of agreement. And remember, though it's a 75 vote, we can engage with the National Assembly Committee, and that means the timing is very important, Yanga. But I must say, the stakeholders here are really quite good, actually. I don't know why. Well, we don't know enough why you said no to what they want. Not all of them, obviously, and not all the things they say. Over to you, Yanga, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I want to apologize for Momo and for France because they are in the Newton Committee. I'll do some of the responses and Chris will do some of the responses and Katinga from SARS will do preliminary responses on the TALAP. But we are available to respond tomorrow, because most of the issues that are being raised here are the issues that have been raised in the Standing Committee on Finance, and we have responded to them. Because the revised TLAB take into account all the issues that the taxpayers are raising. So we are ready to respond tomorrow on the oral issues, as well as on the written comments. Because also on the written comments that they have submitted, for more especially from SAICA, you find that some of the issues have been addressed in the revised TLAB. There's a lot of issues that have been addressed in the revised TLAB that they've submitted in the written comments. That said, Chair, there are two important issues that I'm going to respond to. I think Chris is going to respond also on export tax on scrap metals, as well as on tobacco, and Katinga on the TALAB issues. On the issue of bursaries, before we can provide our formal response tomorrow, I want us, when we go away today, to understand that government is still cognizant of the skills shortage. Skills shortage is still an important factor in our policy making. Hence, we are not removing the exemption on bona fide bursaries. That should be clear, that the exemption is not taken away. It's only when there is an element of salary sacrifice. And it should be noted that the employer on the salary sacrifice is not funding the education, but the employee pays for the education before tax. And as we have said before, because in 1992, this thing was, the element of salary sacrifice was not allowed. In 2006, there were changes. And even when the changes were made in 2006, we said it's justifiable as a matter of legal theory. Because when there is an element of salary sacrifice, one cannot say bona fide bursary. As we have said in our response document, now we are reviewing the position to say, as we have said, it's justifiable as a matter of legal theory that an element of salary sacrifice that does not require a bona fide bursary. Now, we are saying that if there is an element of salary sacrifice, there is no exemption. But if the employer is giving a bona fide bursary on top of the salary package, of which a bursary is a tax deductible expense on the employer, then that is an exemption on the employee's hands. There is no taxable fringe benefit on the employee's hands. And I would like to quote SAICA, because I like what they are saying in paragraph 119, page 18 of their submission, because they are saying that it appears that NT is seeking to ensure that bursaries are provided on a top-up of package basis, which is a highly desirable goal and an ideal to strive for. Meaning that there is an understanding of what we're doing, that if it is a bursary, it should be on top of a salary package, not a salary sacrifice whereby you sacrifice your salary so as to get the benefit. That is not a bursary. And as you have said, we're still cognizant of the skills shortage in the country. We are not taking away the exemption. But what we are doing, we are saying that if there is an element of salary sacrifice, the exemption will not apply. So also, Smart Funder and Invest are saying that the incentive should be on top of an exemption, because they are saying that what we are saying is that only those employees...
Younger, can I just draw your attention to this? Right? You're giving full replies. I thought you'll just give us like heads, our lawyers have heads of arguments, right? Now, it's 12:12. And you know what? Let me start with some fundamental thing. What does the Constitution say about the role of the NCOP, Younger? No matter what happened in the NA, you have to convince us in the NCOP committee. The fact that you dealt with these issues there doesn't mean that we as the NCOP committee may not come to a different view. As I explained in the answer, the only difference, Younger, is that our ability to implement the views that we have is limited by the fact that the section 75O. So we have, but nothing stops us from referring some of these clauses back to the NA. Finally, it's their decision what they do. And at the rate these things are going, it seems that at least some of these clauses are highly questionable. And I'm saying to you, if you're going to repeat to us what you have said in the NA committee purely, that's what you're going to do tomorrow, then you're not helping.
because we're going to say, well, you know what, go back and so on. Now, I will engage with the chief of this evening and the NCOP chair to raise some of our issues that, you know, we're not happy with the answers we are getting, younger. It's not convincing. The fact that the NA arrived at that is their right, but it's equally our right, even if it's a 75 bill, to alert the NA to the fact that, you know, there are some things here. For example, how can you not provide basic facts, which I hope you'll give out, because we won't be happy otherwise. For example, on this matter, what is the loss to the fiscus? What is the nature of the benefits? What are we going to do, given that it's COVID-19 now and we've got no money? How are we going to fund higher education and so on? So those questions are going to be asked again. You know, they are our constitutional duty. So what I'm saying in short is, younger, you're going further than was planned. So you're saying you can do it by tomorrow. You're saying that you'll be ready, bearing in mind that it's not a repetition of what happened in the NA. Otherwise, there's no point in having a second half, is there? So as long as you're clear that we won't just accept exactly what you repeat there. Nothing stops us from asking you to go back and negotiate with the stakeholders where we feel they have a strong case. When we say we feel they have a strong case, younger, we're not saying we agree with them, but we ain't going to agree with you either, unless you give us a strong enough argument. So far, we haven't heard it on this matter, actually. It's not clear enough to us that the weight of the argument is on your side, never mind what happened in the day. So, younger, I suggest, you know what, if you're ready for tomorrow, good. But beware, or be aware, not beware, be aware that we won't just succumb simply because you convinced the NA or you didn't provide all the answers. They, as citizens, well, as stakeholders in a parliamentary democracy, have the right to their answers to their questions. They don't have a right to determine policy. They're not elected politicians. So I think let's defer this thing, because it isn't the time now. We meet at 11 o'clock. Younger, you say you'll be ready tomorrow.
Yes, Chair, we will be ready tomorrow, but if you're saying that...
As long as you're aware, as long as you're aware that we can send you back. You can come with?
If you are saying that you must come on Thursday, we are available to come on Thursday, but we thought we'll be ready tomorrow.
Well, I think you should just look up, ask your lawyers what our rights are as the NCOP committee, and see what is possible for us to do, and take it that we will do whatever the Constitution allows us to do. We have to do our job. So what do you want, younger? I mean, your hands, as it were. But let's hear committee members. Is there anybody? I see in the chat group somebody is saying something. I can't accept this reply. A conscious decision was taken into that decision. Okay, there's Ryder. So it's going to carry on, and we expect a long meeting. But remember, the priority is the appropriations, because we can't adopt the last phase of the appropriations process unless we adopt this one that we're in. So, you know, I'll have to check their times and so on. So for now, what do other members feel? Should we have the meeting tomorrow or postpone it to Thursday?
Okay, it's Dennis here. I think that whichever would get us the best result in terms of a response from Treasury, and I think that Younger needs to understand that we feel that there were compelling arguments made today. Her responses must be equally compelling or more compelling in order to get us to go one way or the other. So if she's prepared to come back for tomorrow, that's great. I like what you said again about having further engagements. You know, we did that last time with Section 12J. And I think a good result came out of that subsequent discussion, and everyone benefited. Everyone benefited. So I think that my personal view, if I was in younger shoes, I might opt for the Thursday. But if she's happy to come tomorrow, then by all means, we're available, Chair. We are ready to.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you, younger. Remember, we will. Yeah, sure. We're not going to intrude on the Appropriations Committee. That you're clear about. I said that already. We will. Your program is very important here. So don't worry about that. Yeah.
Okay.
Is that the only issue you wanted to raise?
Thank you, Chair. I think I see you.
Yeah, but I did say that in the outset. I didn't even know you connected. I said it not knowing you here, that we can't, we'll check what your times are. I will engage, as I said, with the chief whip and with the NCOP chair, and we will, the first point is we're not going to intrude on your program. But we will revolve around, if you have to meet at night, so be it. Virtual meetings have been done up to 9 p.m. at night in terms of the parliamentary rules. And the gentlemen and women who are involved, if they want to, they can join us. If they don't, that's fine. But we are where we are. And Yanga, what we're signaling is you may well be right on everything you've said, but at this stage, they are quite compelling. When we hear, you will come to our own conclusion. What I thought is, if you still have room for discussion, maybe you should do that tomorrow. But it's quite possible after we hear you tomorrow, we might say we're not happy, then go back to the discussion on Thursday. So it is a complex thing, as Dennis says. You see, if you convince, you got very strong replies, and you don't need to engage with anybody, which is your right, but that's not Parliament's, that's your decision. Then you can come tomorrow. If we're unhappy, it gives you Thursday to negotiate with them, and we'll reconvene on Friday afternoon after the Appropriations Committee. If on the other hand, you feel, yes, maybe they do have a case on reflection, given our concern about, our sense that at initial level they have quite good arguments, then you might want to meet with them tomorrow and meet us on Thursday. Or if you feel confident enough, come tomorrow, and then it's possible that we will refer you back to meeting with them on Thursday. So, Yanga, please, we got to move on. What's your view?
Thank you, Chair. I'll take the wisdoms of the members and give us more time. Can we please schedule for Thursday?
Okay, I will then engage with the committee section to find out when meetings are. We can't intrude on caucus. So tentatively, depending on what time the just remind me, since you're here, Chairperson, what time is appropriations meeting on Thursday?
Chairperson, I thought we'll finalize that, because the debate is no more on Friday, it's on Thursday. We can finalize that after the meeting. And
okay, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll sort that out later.
You can talk to
back to Thursday. Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, we'll sort that out. So, colleagues, the understanding is one, the two chairs and then the powers that be will look at it. Two is that rather than meet tomorrow, we meet on Thursday. Three is that whatever happens, we will take a decision based on our constitutionally defined role, not based on being subordinate to the NA. Four, there is no intention whatsoever to simply flex our muscle for the sake of it. That would be stupid. If the NA did the correct thing after reflection, then there's no point for us to. Five, we will have to engage with the fact that 9th of December is sacrosanct, so it'll mean working a lot, maybe even on Monday, which is our political day. But we have to finish, as indeed appropriations has to, otherwise you can't have a budget. Having said that, may I thank everybody. Committee section in Kulilek Mangweni is a very good secretary. He will ensure that you are timely notified about the times of meetings. You'll have to give us a few hours, because there's endless, it's like this virtual meetings gone mad culture. There's three meetings in a row for me, and I'm sure the same applies to the chair of the Appropriations Committee. So I'll only work on this after 7 o'clock this evening. Thank you, and we'll come back to you by tomorrow morning. Thank you all.
Can I? Can we request the members to remain on? Please.
Yeah, they must remain. How long will it be, Dikileni? I've got another meeting at 12, but I'll see.
No, it's just not remain. Announcement.
So can we close the meeting formally? Anybody not a member of the Appropriations Committee and who's not a staff member, can you please exit?